Okay, I think we should start now. So I'm really pleased to introduce our keynote speaker this morning, Vanessa Schwarz. So Vanessa Schwarz is professor of art history and history at the University of Southern California, while she also directs the Visual Studies Research Institute and graduate program. She specializes in 19th and 20th century European and American visual culture, especially film, photography, and design. She is the author of Spectacular Realities, Early Mass Culture in Fin de Siècle Paris, 1998, the prize-winning of It's So French, Hollywood, Paris, and the Making of Cosmopolitan Film Culture in 2007, Modern France, A Very Short Introduction, 2011, in Oxford University's Press Series, and several co-edited volumes, such as Cinema and the Invention of Modern Life, 1995, The 19th Century Visual Culture Reader in 2000, and most recently, Getting the Picture, The Visual Culture of the News in 2015. She recently received fellowships at the Coleman Center at the New York Public Library, at the Lindbergh Chair at the National Museum of Air and Space, and a Guggenheim for a book project, Jet Age Aesthetics, Media and the Glamour of Motion, and from the Mellon Foundation to co-direct a Sawyer seminar with her colleague Daniela Bleichmar on a project called Visual History, the Past in Picture. So our talk today relates to our ongoing project I have just mentioned and is entitled How Tomorrowland Became Today, Disneyland, Transport, and Circulation as Aesthetic in the Jet Age.
Je voudrais commencer en remerciant tout le monde ici, l'équipe de la Fondation Terra, en particulier Francesca, Verla, Constance, et en particulier aussi l'équipe de mon ami François Brunet. Avec ça, je vais parler en anglais parce que François, c'est le chef des études anglophones à Paris. So I will turn to English and thank in particular François for receiving all of us so nicely here and for things being so well run. Also to, of course, John Davis of the Terra, soon to be leaving for his return to Washington. We hope you'll get things in order there, you know, so that our relations franco-américaines can continue to be as good as they've been. So let me just begin. Later this month, this brown line reproduction of an original Herb Ryman map of Disneyland is expected to fetch $1 million at auction in Los Angeles. The report in the New York Times also elicited a number of corrections in letters from Connoisseur because the original article had described the item falsely as Ryman's original drawing, which is hand-drawn on vellum, rather than what is pictured earlier you saw as a hand-colored brown line reproduction. This image is owned by the Disney Studio and is not up for sale. In fact, the Disney Studio is so notoriously protective of its images and archives that access to materials for lawful reproduction is worse, I assure you, than at any artist foundation that anyone in this room has ever encountered. Now, one might imagine that in the context of our consideration of circulation, the work of the Walt Disney Studio could stand as the classic example of Greenbergian kitsch, as any form of mass culture, however exemplary, might be. But the very introduction of such high-stakes monetary value attached to a copy of a map of a theme park suggests the extent to which Disney and Disneyana has far exceeded its status as mass culture, entering into an entirely different realm of cultural circulation and the realm of what we might call, in fact, the art of Walt Disney. I picture for you here two book covers. One, a book called The Art of Walt Disney, published in 1942. That is to say, even this early people were talking about Walt Disney as art. And many of you may know in this room that in 1937, there was an exhibition in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, not the Museum of Modern Art, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, about Snow White. And then The Art of Walt Disney, 1973, a magisterial book that has never been out of print since 1973. And I will be teaching a course when I return from my leave about the art of Walt Disney, not arguing that Walt Disney is art, but about the way in which, from the beginning, Walt Disney was always considered, in fact, great art, and is not since, say, Andy Warhol, been recuperated as art, but since, in fact, the 1920s, it was considered not only exemplary, but in fact, art. So, and I think it's certainly interesting and really important that the Terra Foundation, whose mission is bringing the visual arts of the United States to the attention of the world, now acknowledges that that most important of American artists, Walt Disney, be brought here to France. And of course, we didn't need to have the Terra Foundation bring Walt Disney to France, because when Walt Disney died, Paris Match put his death on the cover, Adieu à Walt Disney, with Mickey crying. So it's not exactly news. And just again, to say that I'm not a kind of, you know, curious, strange person, many of you may remember the enormously successful Grand Palais exposition, Il était une fois Walt Disney aux sources de l'art des studios Disney, of 2006-07. There was also an exposition last year over at those new kind of exhibition space by the Galle d'Austerlitz, also on the art of Walt Disney. But this one produced a very important catalog as well, and there have been other expos, but this is the one from recent memory. But the image with which I began, and of course the original Ryman image, was intended as preparatory work made by a former studio employee that Walt Disney had recalled to secretly work in 1953 on a project for a park that would open in July 1955 as Disneyland. The artist, Herb Ryman, would return to work for what was called WED Enterprises, a separate company from the Walt Disney Studios, as one of the original group of people who would later be known as Imagineers, that most boundary-defying of modern creative artists who built Disneyland, which I'll discuss today. Imagineers provided, quote, imaginative concepts in design, architecture, engineering, and entertainment, unquote. This is from a 1963 brochure, having trained in none of the above. They were mostly animators at the start, but they created what Richard Schickel, in one of the earliest sustained interpretations of the park, written in 1968, called, quote, one of the best mixed media shows ever devised, unquote, an example of Marshall McLuhan's Global Village, unquote. And we talked about McLuhan and mixed media already yesterday. Certainly, as an object of study, Disneyland requires a promiscuity of method or interpretive circulation across the borders and boundaries of multiple fields of study, but one that also reflects the intellectual ingenuity and adaptability of the park's creators, who were people who, for example, had no actual idea about how to build a car, but they did so anyway. You might call this on the virtues of de-skilling. In studying a phenomena such as Disneyland, it doesn't really help to identify the usual boundaries between fields such as architecture, urban planning, film, design, painting, sculpture, photography. Rather, it's better to circulate across them as they converge and intersect. Additionally, it's hard to think of Disneyland as a singular object, and not just because it is now, of course, in, here is Disneyland, but also Orlando, Paris, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and the newest one, Shanghai. Even within the actual berm itself, one can't simply study visual materials alone, something again François talked about yesterday, nor expect that the logic of the single or complete art objects underrides anything about Disneyland. In fact, this is why Walt Disney himself was drawn to building the park and away from filmmaking. And I quote, "Disneyland is something that will never be finished. It's alive. It will be a living, breathing thing that will need change. A picture is a thing. I wanted something alive, something that could grow. Not only can I add things, but even the trees will grow and become more beautiful each year," unquote. But it wasn't just nature that would organically grow at Disneyland, nor would the park function like a cultivated garden. What Walt had done in films, which you could say, of course, make inert drawings come to life, that's what animation does. That's, of course, what the cinema is, and we could call that the Pinocchio effect. He had sought to do in three dimensions. As architectural critic Ada Louise Huxtable observed of the park, Disneyland, quote, "This is a world where the kinetic energy created by constant movement was an attraction in itself," unquote. And that's really the banner for today. In other words, Disneyland, I'm going to suggest, aestheticized motion in the form of transport as circulation. Now, I'm certainly not the first academic to study Disneyland. Yet most independent studies are not histories. They are, in fact, critiques developed through what I'd call the road trip method. Perhaps those trips are most memorably made by a trio of European semiologists in the late 70s and early 80s, Louis Marin, Umberto Eco, and Jean Baudrillard, who offered tendentious ideological critiques of the United States that masqueraded as semiotic analyses of Disneyland. They identified the condition of hyperreality in Disneyland, whose purpose was to make us believe that the rest of America was real, quote, when in fact all of Los Angeles and the America surrounding it are no longer real, but of the order of the hyperreal and of simulation, unquote. That's Baudrillard. Eco called Disneyland, quote, a masterpiece of falsification, unquote, the Sistine Chapel of the hyperreal United States of America, unquote. This was written, needless to say, well before 2007, a mere 15 years after the opening of Disneyland Paris, when the park in Marne-la-Vallée had already overtaken both the Louvre and the Eiffel Tower as the most visited tourist destination in all of Europe. Now, my own first book, I've got a slide out of place. Now, my own first book, Spectacular Realities, was written as a response to this European point of view. I argued that this condition that they describe was not exclusively a function of a diabolical American genius for inauthenticity by taking a long view of the subject. It seemed that one could find the origins of a certain form of realism in European modernity, as Walter Benjamin had described it. There was no hyperreal USA and real Europe. Wasn't Disneyland simply descended from the world's fairs begun in Europe? Hadn't Paris been the capital of the 19th century while Americans were crossing the prairie in covered wagons? Who built the Eiffel Tower, as Holly showed us yesterday? Didn't the Lumiere brothers invent the movies in 1895? Well, that was the long view. And today, I want to take a short view and recontextualize Disneyland in mid-century America. And since then, I did Spectacular Realities, I've had a little time in between then and now to actually learn something about mid-century America. So that's the advantage of actually learning something between graduate school and now. And what I've learned is that American scholarship on Disney and Disneyland, which took off in the decades after these European critiques in the 1980s, is still also hampered by nearly impossible access to archival materials. And it is more or less divided into two general orientations. One group of scholars that approaches the park from the perspective of its content, symbols and myths, as a performance of ideology. They argue that Disneyland repeats and fosters American racial and economic exclusion. They see the park as a place that promotes white supremacy, nostalgia, imperial expansion, consumer idealism, heteronormativity, crypto-fascism, you name it. To such critics, Disneyland is indeed a very dangerous place, especially because it performs all of this ideological mystification with a smile on its face to an unwitting audience. Another branch of scholarship is more preoccupied with the way that Disneyland fits into a history of spatial utopias, gardens and tivolis, such as the idealized European royal gardens of the early modern world, complete, of course, with water elements and animals. Others locate it more squarely within the history of urban planning in the American West. Now, in what follows, I consider the history of Disneyland from its initial conceptualization in 1952 through its first phase, when Disney died a rather untimely death from lung cancer in December of 1966 at the age of 65. And since I live in California, I will warn you, European smokers, because he smoked constantly. And that is why he died of lung cancer in 1965. So that's my little American Californian moment. So I locate Disneyland as part of the broader visual and technological culture of which it was a part by arguing that it functioned as the key site where technology and aesthetic experience converged at mid-century. Why is this important? Because for people like us, it offers a much larger framework for understanding why such an artist as Rauschenberg was working with NASA in the first place, for example. Disneyland, I'm suggesting, was a quintessential project of the jet age whose very dawn it heralded. The park organized and aestheticized the experience of mid-century modernity, especially the fluid motion of the kinetic culture of that most flashy of modern transports, the jet. One so significant that it came to stand in for its own moment at the time, which was christened the Jet Age, which is the only age named at its own moment, the Jet Age. We think of the Railway Age, that comes after the Victorian period. It was not called the Railway Age in its own moment. So in my larger project that I'm working on, I ask how the jet, this speedy new transport, reorganized human perception in the decade from its advent in the mid-50s to the mid-60s, so much so that people came to be imagined as living in a constant state of motion, whether they actually took a jet plane or not. Although one might think that what distinguished the jet was its speed. In fact, this was hardly the sum total of the jet's advantages. By flying at a higher altitude made possible by faster speeds, jets were less turbulent. Without the piston-operated engine, the ride was quiet, and the plane had little of its characteristic vibration. Flying in jets, as a 1954 Newsweek article noted, quote, will seem like slipping through space. No vibrations, no lurches, no sense of speed, unquote. In short, the ride itself made the trip less physically exhausting and less of an unpleasant experience. As a result, such jet mobility, high-tech movement, was naturalized and ordered. Technologically driven motion and mobility, even on the ground, was reimagined as beautiful, constant, fluid, and painless. Artists in many domains contributed to this jet age fantasy, well beyond the visual culture, I'm going to skip that for now, associated with, this is an image of the 707, the first Boeing jet, well beyond this kind of imagery. So people who have worked on jet culture tend to stay very close, and they're a little literal, like, you know, the visual culture of the jet are like airline posters. And I really wanted to get out of that, you know, kind of being a historian of the visual culture of transport. I felt that was a little literal. So I'm not writing a book about airline posters, but this is one dimension of what some have worked on although there isn't actually, it turns out, too much on the visual culture of the airlines themselves. So in other words, artists did contribute to a certain visual culture, but what I'm trying to do is look beyond this kind of artistic rendering of the visual culture of the jet. And one of the things I'm trying to argue is that Disneyland is one of the great expressions of jet age aesthetics. Now, the history of Disneyland itself literally emerged from Walt Disney wanting to respond to the public interest in touring his studio, which he understood was not much of an attraction. He experimented with this by making a studio tour film called The Reluctant Dragon in 1941. But then he decided he would install a small park and a train ride across from his newfangled studio that he had built in Burbank. And that studio, of course, already shared many elements that would appear at Disneyland, such things as purpose-built furniture, whimsical and thematic design. The Burbank studio was a cross between a campus and a city. There were things like Dopey Drive and Mickey Avenue. At the same time, a miniature train fad was sweeping through America, but also the studio counted among its animators several hobbyists who had built their own working trains in their own backyards. And by 1949, Walt Disney had built the Carrollwood Pacific Line going through his own backyard in Holmby Hills. Now, as plans for Disneyland took shape from the start, it would have a train, and this is the original entrance of Disneyland, circling around the park. It's the first thing you see, which, like Walt Disney's backyard, would be enclosed inside of a berm so that you could not see the outside world that you would create within the park. Now, before it was a place, and some of you may know this, Disneyland was actually a television show whose planning and building was broadcast weekly, starting October 27, 1954, until the opening of the park in July of 1955. The broadcast was necessary so that ABC would finance and invest in the park. And I don't have the time to describe the drama between Walt and his brother Roy, but that is why there is a separate company called WED, because Walt took all of his money, including his life insurance, including his house in, you know, the desert, which he sold to try to finance Disneyland, and needed the money, and eventually essentially sold himself to ABC TV to raise the money. And ABC owned most of Disneyland until 1960, when they had made so much money in Disneyland that Walt bought it back from ABC. But in other words, in order to raise the money for Disneyland, he had to agree to make a TV show. And what he did was make a TV show called Disneyland. And every week for months, he sold Disneyland on TV. As Disney would say, in order to get a TV show, ABC bought a park. I just want to show you a clip from that TV show.
Here now to tell you about it is Walt Disney.
Welcome. I guess you all know this little fella here. It's an old partnership. Mickey and I started out the first time many, many years ago. We've had a lot of our dreams come true. Now we want you to share with us our latest and greatest dream. That's it, right here. Disneyland, seen from about 2,000 feet in the air and 10 months away. I want to tell you about it because later on in the show, you'll find that Disneyland the place and Disneyland the TV show are all part of the same. Now, on a site of 240 acres near the city of Anaheim in Southern California, right about in here, we've begun to build Disneyland the place. We hope that it will be unlike anything else on this earth. Amusement park, an exhibition, a city from the Arabian Nights, metropolis from the future. In fact, a place of hopes and dreams, facts and fancy, all in one. Now, next year, our television show will be coming from this Disneyland. But this year, we want you to see and share with us the experience of building this dream into a reality.
Now, if I had a lot of time, I would linger on every visual version of how Disneyland was just shown, because it's fascinating. The backlit map of Disneyland, which actually is I know quite a bit about, but just again, and the kind of invoking of 19th century techniques for that, for those of you who know a lot about, you know, daguerre and diorama technology, but we don't have time for that. Let me just say what was interesting is his description also of what Disneyland would be. And elsewhere, he called it a combined amusement park, public wonderland, fair, carnival, showplace of magic and living facts, wondrously devised for the visitor's participation. Another press release called it a world's fair, a playground, a futuristic city and tropical park, all rolled into a permanent landmark. In other words, it was going to be a little bit of everything and like nothing you've ever seen before. And they were right, and whatever it was an immediate success. Now, there's a great deal to describe about the look and the structure of Disneyland in 1955, and then to, of course, describe its history, but I'm going to have to condense quite a lot here. So I think what's important is that many of the analyses of Disneyland have focused on what we'll call the theming of the different lands, and the uses especially of detailism to achieve, say, the nostalgia of Main Street, the imperialism of Adventureland and Frontierland, to render the transformation of Disney films in three dimensions in Fantasyland. In fact, the challenge of the very detailism is what presented challenges, for example, in places like Tomorrowland. How do you render something you've never seen and you only imagine in a kind of hyperreal environment? Most of these people have focused on hyperrealism and simulation. And those are, of course, the European critiques. On the eventual, they've also liked to talk about reanimation produced by audio animatronics, which were introduced in 1963 in the Enchanted Tiki Room. And here, I'll give you a little clip of the Tiki Room if you're not familiar.
No.
Of course, audio animatronics.
In the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room, the little birds sing birds and the flowers grow. In the tiki 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 room, welcome to our tropical hideaway. You lucky people, you. If we wanna finish show, stopping right away, we think.
Now, I showed you that for a very specific reason, because the Imagineer Mark Davis explained of the Tiki Room, rides should be what people don't expect them to be, and it doesn't have a lot to do with continuity of story. It does have to do with the entertainment value of surprise and seeing things you can't see anyplace else. This is why in the Tiki Room, all the birds sing words and the flowers croon. In other words, Disneyland is not merely a simulation of the real world. Birds don't sing. Flowers don't croon. No one flies over London in a pirate ship, to my knowledge. Not yet. So I would argue that is so much for the hyperreality argument, but I don't want to dwell on that subject actually here. Now, in addition to rides that went through artificially constructed environments, assuring what we could call virtual voyages, which I have to put aside for the sake of time, which are important aspects of the Disneyland experience, and I think which come out of the tradition of the expositions, I want instead to focus on the freestanding transportation that saturated the park and is one of its, I would say, its central narrative, turning motion into an attraction in and of itself. At the park, Walt Disney engaged his interest in people moving by turning transport into the glue that bound the different lands. He turned a need into an attraction and a narrative, foregrounding the constant movement between the attractions as well as that of the guests into the basis of what the park was about. Eventually, he used that experience to move his own work well beyond the realm of mere entertainment as his work evolved beyond Disneyland in the last years of his life. So aside from the train that goes around the park, Main Street, when you first walk in, is teeming with things like old-time omnibuses, delivery trucks, trolleys, all made up, purpose-built, just for Disneyland. They're all fake. None of them are from the real world. Surreys, another Disney craft. In Frontierland, it's all about water. Watercraft ply the artificially constructed rivers of America. Here, The Mark Twain is a working steamship built for Disneyland. The three-masted Columbia, the Mike Fink keel boats, and, of course, the Indian War canoes. This defines the history of westward expansion. New kinds of transport, such as the Skyway, which was a Swiss innovation that was brought to Disneyland and redesigned, the buckets were redesigned, for Disneyland, and also, of course, the German-American monorail, again, the first redesigned working monorail in North America called the Highway in the Sky, and first operated not just in America, but in the Western Hemisphere, operated in Disneyland. Now, together, these forms of freestanding transport, not ride-throughs, but mere rides, offered movement as an aesthetic, as well, I'd suggest, as an overall narrative of progress. At Disneyland, history progressed through the history of transport technology that led us, of course, into the future, into the jet age, and to the moon and beyond. And this is Tomorrowland and the TWA rocket to the moon ride, which I assure you that in 1959 they actually didn't have rockets to the moon. Now, the crowning achievement of Disney's transport innovation led to Tomorrowland and to the eventual inauguration of the all-American, all-Disney, Wedway People Mover. And this is an image of the Wedway People Mover. And I want to show you here. Well, I'm going to actually hold off the clip for a minute. What began as Walt Disney's vision, so I'm going to go back to this. What began as Walt Disney's vision of people moving finally became an actual vehicle itself, the People Mover. This was called the Wedway, Wed, W-E-D, Walt Elias Disney, People Mover. That was the name of the vehicle, the People Mover. The People Mover was unveiled for the 1967 renovation of Tomorrowland, whose press release explained, quote, "The structural lines of Tomorrowland convey an impression of constant movement in keeping with the ceaseless activity throughout Tomorrowland. It's a series of vehicles that never stop moving, even when passengers are boarding or debarking, vehicles that can't collide, compartment doors that open and close by themselves." Almost all, of course, 20th century visions of futuristic cities seem to be characterized by the idea of ceaseless activity. But the emphasis on fluid motion, on a sort of naturalized choreography in which nothing actually stops, is what I would call pure jet age, even on the ground or on an elevated track. Now, Disneyland's commitment to turning people moving into an art and simultaneously aestheticizing motion began with the project of designing the park. As John Hench, one of the original park Imagineers, explained, Walt was always looking for inventive ways of moving guests around. In fact, according to Dick Irvine, who also participated in the original park construction, he and Disney would visit Knott's Berry Farm, which was a ghost town amusement park in Buena Park, only miles from Anaheim, which had been operating since 1940. And Walt would go there and study traffic flow, quote, how people moved about. Even at the time, he had in the back of his mind that he wanted to know how people moved. It wasn't so much as to what went into this stuff. He just wanted to know how to handle people, unquote. Joe Potter, an MIT-trained engineer who oversaw the 1964 World's Fair and subsequently headed Disney's Florida project, explained, Walt was interested in what attracted people, held their attention, and moved them in and out. So although we might think of Disneyland as a maze of endless waits and lines, it was and remains one of the great examples of crowd management and control, given the vast numbers of people that actually move in and out and through the park every day. Disney made a priority of creating a rational approach to crowd movement, so much so that he developed a long-term relationship with Harrison Buzz Price, first of the Stanford Research Institute, and then of his own firm, Economics Research Associates, who had one client, WED Enterprises. Price not only determined Disneyland's optimal site in Anaheim, but also estimated attendance numbers, numbers of attractions, how many people could ride an attraction per hour in order for them to build the park around the idea of optimizing the experience of visitors in the park space. Although Disney didn't use architects to build the park, Pereira and Luckman advised him regarding certain key principles, such as having only one entrance, which they believed would create a sense of orientation for park visitors. Disney himself conceived the park's basic... They conceived the basic spatial concept of the hub, which would allow visitors to both freely circulate while being easily oriented at the same time, and they'd be able to return to the spacious hub with their families, open maps, and be able to talk in groups about where they would go next. Disney's method was also very much in keeping with those spatial planners of his own era, which is to say it was straight out of the jet age. In particular, I want to suggest he worked exactly like airport planners. As Hench further explained, Walt would tell us to go and watch people. See how they behave. Don't force them down artificial paths. You have to study people. Disney spent lots of time in the park. He had an apartment in the park, just like, by the way, Eiffel had an apartment on the top of the Eiffel Tower. He observed how guests used the spaces. When a maintenance director explained that they would have to fence in a flower bed because people kept walking across it, Hench explained that Disney said, no, you don't put a fence around it. When guests make their own path, they have a damn good reason for doing it. This was, after all, the era of the rise of ergonomics. As Henry Dreyfuss, author of the key text, Designing for People, 1955, put it, when the point of contact between the product and the people becomes a point of friction, then the industrial designer has failed. Airport planners working to design for new jet age airports took the same approach as Disney. During the design phase, for example, for the TWA terminal at Idlewild, Eero Saarinen and his firm visited other airports to see how people move through space. According to his colleague, Kevin Roach, quote, we would travel to airports and time planes taking on passengers, the time it took to go from sidewalk to ticketing, checking your bag, stopwatch timing, all these things. And I can tell you it's true because here's a graph that actually is Kevin Roach timing the movements. And this I found in the Eames papers because actually Saarinen sent Eames 250 pages of data because the Eames made a movie called The Expanding Airport for Saarinen when Saarinen was building Dulles. And all of you who are interested in architectural history, always interested in the big, concrete, beautiful building, Saarinen didn't care about his building. He built it last. It was the last thing he planned. What did Saarinen care about at Dulles Airport? The mobile lounge, the people-moving bus. He spent all his time and all his energy getting the Eames to make a cartoon movie to get the FAA to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for a bus. That's what Dulles is about. Not the concrete, architectural, modernist. He didn't care. He didn't think about it. It was the last thing he did at Dulles. So, architectural historians, please take note. Stop looking at the buildings. Start looking at the people moving. So, in any event, successful people moving depended on creating spaces that actually already accounted for how people naturally moved. That is what people in this era cared about. The other element these large-scale people-moving projects engaged in was anticipating for growth and designing buildings that were flexible, that would allow for change. As Walt had said, Disneyland will never be finished. So the park and airports were also designed for expansion and development. They were flexible. They were modular. They were imagined as always changing spaces. And I don't have a lot of time to talk about all of that. The other thing to say briefly is that this isn't just a kind of, you know, analogy. It turns out there are real connections between real people in jet culture and Disneyland. In other words, the first general manager of Disneyland, C.V. Wood, had worked in the airline industry before coming to Disney. Van Arsdale France, the original director of Tomorrowland, and the eventual dean of Disney University, yes, there is one, also came from the aerospace company General Dynamics. The very first park design, although rejected by Disney, was drawn by Pereira and Luckman. They, of course, were the master planners of LAX, the 1961 jet age design, which is the footprint of the airport today. Never been redesigned from 1961 because it was designed for constant updating and renovation, which is what has happened since 1961. Despite Disney's initial rejection of the plan by Pereira and Luckman, they did, however, design the Disneyland Hotel. And you will see and notice that the Disneyland Hotel is, like the airport itself, a kind of modular, moving, you know, kind of, I don't have time to really talk too much about it, but, and the monorail eventually moves to it in 1959. But this is the first, what LAX is one of the first decentralized terminal models. Like, where's the airport? Like, where is it? Where are the terminals, right? You can't even see the, so what they had were underground tunnels at LAX, and you would go out to the terminals. They are essentially, they're not there, they're just a concrete block. And this gave enormous flexibility and change. They're not big buildings. This is what, and this is, of course, what later, as you all know from Charles de Gaulle, this is the model that is picked up at Charles de Gaulle, actually. The decentralized airport model comes from this. What these projects share is a design dedicated to people moving rather than monumental architecture. But of course, the design similarities of people were and personnel were shared. There is a design similarity. Again, you say, yes, but you know there aren't monumental buildings. But what about that theme building? Well, of course, the theme building was designed by Welton Becket, the architect. Guess what? He's a very good friend of Walt Disney's. He's his neighbor in Holmby Hills. He also designs several projects later for Disney. At Disney World, especially the Polynesian Hotel, among others. But as one of his, and he's the guy who did the Capitol Records building, too, Welton Becket. Now, as one observer remarked about Tomorrowland, it looked not unlike the TWA terminal at Idlewild. But actually, this, Disneyland, is 1955. This is built before Saarinen built this. Saarinen gets the commission for TWA in 1956. And I've been desperate to find whether, of course, TWA says to Saarinen, make it look like this. This is our Marc Fabrique. Make your terminal. Everyone again, you know, all the Saarinen people are like the genius, came up with this concrete thing. But I got to tell you, looks an awful lot like this to me. So, you know, whatever you want to say, and of course, Saarinen, architectural historians do say that he was a kind of corporate tool. That, you know, everyone agrees. And what I have not yet, I can't get it from the Disney people, no one at Disney has provided any information saying that Saarinen came, you know, was able to get this material from them. But he did get the commission in 56, a year after the TWA rocket to the moon ride was opened. Now, such associations between Disneyland and the airport are not lost in the public. It's not just me making this up. In a preview article in the New York Times, they called Los Angeles International Airport a Disneyland for adults. When the airport opened in 1962, the FAA chairman, Najib Halaby, quipped, quote, "You will have the first airport terminal area specifically designed for the jet age, and it may well achieve some of the world renown, some of the international acclaim, as who knows, Disneyland." Within 6 years of Disneyland's opening, 25 million people had visited the park in Anaheim, which may also have accounted for some of the airport's expansion. 99.9% of Disney visitors surveyed said they would recommend a visit to a friend. For every child who went to Disneyland, four adults attended. By 1967, 12 years after the park opened, attendance had increased by 108%. Such was the worldwide fame of Disneyland that by the time of the World's Fair of 1964, nearly 10 years after Disneyland, Welton Becket explained that Robert Moses desperately courted Walt Disney to get involved in the fair. There, Disney was now in the position to explain to architects how to use public space, how to locate concessions, how to make the toilets work, where the ticketing should go, and how it should work to move people effectively and efficiently. Now, there's a separate and important story to tell about Walt Disney at the World's Fair, which I am doing. This is just more on the rocket to the moon. I'm doing in my book, and that was material at the New York Public Library where I was last year, and I don't have a lot of time because I've already gone on very long. So I will only say, of course, that the Magic Skyway is also a story of the history of transportation, sponsored by Ford. Of course, this is where Small World debuts and ends up moving back to Disneyland. Small World at the fair, of course, audio animatronics is what debuts there. And there at the fair, Disney uses corporations to, in a sense, do his research and design for him. He used companies like General Electric and Ford and Pepsi to create and pay for audio animatronics, which at the time they called the grand synthesis of the arts, the Gesamtkunstwerk. Audio animatronics, they called the Gesamtkunstwerk. It combined lifelike and fanciful objects with sound, pre-programmed and coordinated by tape. And the Ford Magic Skyway is extremely interesting. Welton Beckett designed it. So that's the first building that Beckett actually designs for Disney, and it has this characteristic thing of the tunnel on the outside of the building, which becomes a very classic Disney feature where you see part of the attraction from the outside, again, to lure you into it and also to watch people in motion. It's one of my arguments. You have to see people moving. That's part of the attraction, part of the lure. Riders entered Riders entered the Magic Skyway in a new Ford convertible, the 1964 Mustang, mounted on one of the ingenious technological aspects of the attraction, a belt on which the cars were affixed and which moved passengers at exactly the same rate of speed. The automation of the loading process reduced wait time and became part of other Disney attractions back at Disneyland, like the WED Wedway People Mover. So here's where the birth of the People Mover is. And again, Disney figured this out himself by visiting Ford and saw how the assembly line worked. They figured out how to make the People Mover, in a sense, by putting these cars on that belt. And in this story, there's a long internal story about the history of transportation and the creation of the wheel with, you know, cavemen and audio animatronics. I don't have time for that. But if transportation is progress may have been the attraction's manifest narrative, the inside caveman story, the mode of transport was as meaningful as the content. So a booklet describing the pavilion emphasized comfort, convenience, the fact that no effort would be required of its passengers, whose engineless cars were powered and guided by a central control panel. The car would seem as if the vehicle were, quote, riding on a cushion of air, like the experimental Ford, these are people going into the tunnel, Ford Levacar. Will it also fly, they asked? Although it appears that nothing could be more quaint than Small World, you've all been or heard of Small World, it goes in a boat. Its promotional material explained that the boats are propelled at the rate of 2 feet per second by silent hidden jet streams beneath the waterline of the channel. This wedge system eliminates vibration, noise, and engine fumes. So in other words, even Small World is essentially running like a jet. In other words, the history was a history of progress through transport technology, and soon cars and little boats would be as smooth as flying in jets. And everything would essentially be a kind of jet age vehicle. Now, as Disneyland evolved, there is little question that Disney distracted himself from the studio, from films, and even from his park. So fewer than 10 years into its existence, we know that he went to the World's Fair. But it's really the art of people moving and the simultaneous aestheticization of circulation that would come to define the direction of his career, which, as I said, ended rather abruptly. And this would move him beyond the berm. On the boards were plans for the Mineral Kings Ski Resort, whose key element was to be an internal transport system where people left their cars very far away from the village. This is an image of the 1960s Squaw Valley Olympics, which many of you may know was the first Olympics to have had an Olympic village built by WED, by Imagineering. Also the first Olympics where there were spectacular opening and closing ceremonies, giant sculptures in ice, all of which was produced by Walt Disney, or WED company. Meanwhile, while all this was going on, in a secret room in Glendale at WED, the Florida project was well underway. Walt had become especially excited, in fact, about the renovation of Tomorrowland, which I showed you the image of WED Enterprises and the Wedway People Mover, because what he liked now about Tomorrowland is that he envisioned that Tomorrowland would serve to make prototypes of prototypes. What do I mean by that? New Tomorrowland, let's see if I have a, New Tomorrowland would become a real space lab in which to test out elements of his newest and biggest secret project known as the Florida Project, which of course would
another view of Epcot's transportation hub. And see how traffic flows through the heart of the city on three separate levels. At the bottom of the stack is the truck route, reserved for supply vehicles. Trucks will have easy access to all loading docks and service elevators for the delivery
this
of commercial goods.
Is a film, a
the middle level is the automobile
Epcot
throughway, exclusively for cars.
It's the last film Walt
adjacent
Disney made in October. He died in December. There's a whole introductory sequence with Walt in it where
no
he had to have oxygen between takes.
Flow of traffic through the center of Epcot.
I don't have time to show it to you, but this is the explanation of how Epcot would work.
Freeways will not be Epcot's major way of entering and leaving the city.
Just want to show you there.
And passengers.
The point is, at Epcot would be
the, cars you see
the Wedway People Mover.
5/8 scale, considerably smaller than full-size passenger cars would be for city use.
And so the point is, they would try out transport at Disneyland and then bring it to Epcot. Epcot was going to be a real place. It was an experimental, prototypical community of tomorrow. It wasn't to be a theme park. It was to be a real place. But of course, instead, Disney dies, and the rest, as it were, is history. So to conclude, as we consider questions of circulation in the history of art and aesthetic experience, I'd suggest that we need to think of transport as more than an experience that becomes rendered as a motif in art. If part of what we do as historians is trace genealogies, then this look back suggests that the rise of our connected, technological, fast-moving world happened not at the expense of aesthetic experience, but largely because of the central role played by American artists in embracing it and advancing it, where the mid-century two-culture divide simply does not hold. Now, I've here only scratched the surface of the complex original work of the large team of creative people, men and women who worked at the Disney Studio and WED Enterprises, now called Imagineering, in the service of what I've been calling techno-aesthetics, where images become places through technology. Inert things didn't appear to move, they actually did. Whatever your sense of the validity regarding Disney's claim that his park was the happiest place on earth, it certainly is as powerful a form of American art that the world has ever known. And his complex claim upon its opening is worth noting. Disneyland, he said, is dedicated to the dreams and hard facts that have created America, with a hope that it will be a source of joy and inspiration to all the world. Dreams and hard facts. Imagineering, the basis of techno-aesthetics. Without writing the history of phenomena such as these, I cannot possibly imagine understanding the history of American art. Because not only is it so much a part of its story, but it helps explain why, in the 21st century, we finally care to pay any attention to American art in the first place. Thank you.
thanks, Vanessa, for that tour de force. A few linked questions. Why would Walt Disney and Vanessa Schwartz propose transport as progress in that time and place? Are all types of movement good and equal in the study? It strikes me as perhaps not irrelevant that this region is also important for the aerospace industry, that it, as far as I know, mass transit in this region had been successfully diminished and purposefully diminished, and that in terms of moving people, most of the people who arrived at Disneyland arrive via automobiles, and they moved and didn't move while being stuck in traffic and making pollution and the rest. So how do you configure that context regarding your subject in the jet age? Because it's not only the jet age, it's also, yeah.
First, the point is, you say why this transport now is because I think it is a moment of enormous change because of the jet. And the jet does two things. It makes California, so this story about Disneyland is so important because, of course, without the jet, California is far from many places. With the jet, California is brought into proximity in ways that is absolutely not to be accomplished earlier. And that, of course, is also true. You know, we forget this. People like to talk about, you know, the boat in Europe and transatlantic, blah, blah. But, you know, it's 1958 already. More people fly across the Atlantic than take the boat, it turns out. Even though everyone here probably remembers the SS France, and everyone I knew, even in the 70s, were taking the SS France, turns out already the plane had eclipsed people on the boat. So these distances, once the plane exists, are really breached. So that in terms of, you're absolutely right that California is a location of aerospace, which is why Disney can find all these people to work for him from aerospace. In other words, it's there. Also making the materials for Disneyland, all that fiberglass, all that, all local. In other words, some of it's in Northern California, but in other words, the materials of Disneyland are the plastics, the absolutely, this is why people have, this guy named Peter Westwick, who's working on surfing culture, and that the materials of surfboards that, you know, change in this period also come from aerospace industry. So there's no question that it's an enormous boom industry, whereas I would say that car ownership increases in this period. It's a kind of enormous, it's the baby boom, it's a great period of, it's the 30 glorious for everybody. So car ownership goes up, but there have already been cars for a long time in America. So what I would say is this moment is marked by this technology that really does have a giant impact. So it's more important, and more importantly, it's not that it's realer. It's one of the points I think that's important to talk about here is it's a, there's a difference between the facts on the ground about what an airplane does and how many people go in airplanes, because still, actually, it's only about a third of people in the 50s and 60s are flying on airplanes in America, and in France, it's even fewer. So I'm not talking about real people are going on airplanes. This is a vision, and about how artists and design people are influenced by and shaping an aesthetic response. So it's not like, did people get on airplanes and what difference does it make? It's more like people say a jet does this. It's smooth, it's fluid. And that becomes a kind of organizing principle of how we're going to rearrange the world. Do you see what I mean? So that's the first thing. As to cars, that's like saying, well, yes, people did arrive in cars. They also arrived to LAX. I mean, the numbers in LAX are wild, right? That's why they rebuild the airport. A lot of that is because of Disneyland, but not only. I mean, tourism in Southern California in general increases in this period. So yes, I don't actually believe the who killed Roger Rabbit scenario. I think people want cars. You know, look at Paris, where there's excellent public transport. Everybody knows that they have had to do a million things to prevent people from driving their cars in Paris. And there is excellent public transport in Paris, and people still buy cars in Paris and still want to drive cars in Paris. Clisson, you have your car here? Huh? Tell the truth. So, okay, but in other words, so even the point, Todd, is that even in a city like Paris, where there is superb public transportation, there has been an increase and increase where there is more money and more availability to buy cars, there have been more cars. And all they've had to do is fight to reduce people's ability to drive their cars in Paris. So, you know, it's not some like secret plot. You don't need to create secret plots to kill public transport. People prefer their cars.
Is there, just one follow-up question on that. Is the, there are also suburbs around Paris and suburbs in Southern California. Is the suburb thematized within the Disney park?
When you say
and if not, why not?
Some people would argue, well, you know, is Main Street? I mean, no, Main Street is a kind of old-fashioned town. At the time that Disneyland is built, of course, there's not even Irvine. There's not any of those communities that you think of as the Orange County suburbs. It is the place they pick it because they have determined that there will be the greatest growth around Disneyland, which is what happens. But, of course, what most people didn't understand at the time is that Disneyland itself contributed to that growth much more than they realized it would. So Harrison Price says this growth will be here whether we're here or not, but then it turns out Disneyland creates that growth. So there's nothing suburban, I would say, about Disneyland. No, it's not really thematized. A lot of people could say, well, Tomorrowland, the Monsanto House of the Future, of course. The great thing about the Monsanto House of the Future is that, like a suburban community, they kind of can't kill it. I don't know if anyone knows this, but they can't really take it apart. It's hard to kill. And there's still the footprint of the Monsanto House of the Future at Disneyland because they couldn't take the whole thing down. It's like impossible to kill the plastic, turns out. So, I mean, of course. But I think, you know, I mean, I know you want me to say something like, you know, cars are bad, public transport would be better, but, you know, I'm not going to say that. Holly and then Robin?
Yeah. Vanessa, thank you. There's so many things that one could say. One of them is to say thank you for reminding me about some of the happiest hours of my life were spent in the Enchanted Tiki Room.
There you go.
And it's very worthwhile having that brought back to consciousness. I wanted to ask you about something else. One of the things that emerges from your analysis is a kind of rereading of the Anaheim Disneyland site as a kind of, I'm still digesting this, as a kind of mechanized spatial utopia in which there are all these opportunities to move about. And one of the things that I remember most vividly from my trips to Disneyland in the 1960s was the way in which the ticket structure produced an extremely vexing hierarchy, which is to say, the park, you know this, the park was divided into E-ticket attractions, D-ticket attractions, and so forth, and you had only a certain quantity of those depending on the ticket package that you bought at the door, and you were put into a queue depending upon the kind of tickets that you had and the number you had left and so forth, and everybody wanted to go on the E-ticket rides because they were the grooviest and so on. And so what I remember is all of these, you know, all of these possibilities to engage in, let's call it mechanized transport, but you were nonetheless brought to a halt as a consequence of the ticket structure. So it ended up mirroring other aspects of the American class system there inside this utopic place. So, yeah, and I should also say, just for the record, I was, of course, raised in a household that insisted that the only communists used public transportation. So there. Anyway, voila. So the question about tickets moving against... Well, it's time. I should admit that.
No.
tickets versus mechanized transport.
Okay, so that's a really important question. And this is where you know, you bang your head against the wall and you feel like, really, people, this is innocent information that if I could have, I'm not going to, like, unlock the key to some ruining Mickey's reputation. So, in other words, there's something called the Park Operations Committee. They functioned from 1955 forward. I have seen memos of the Park Operations Committee But do you think, because I actually have entered the Disney archive. And as I said to someone yesterday, and I actually spent two nights about 3 weeks ago before I came to France, convinced literally that I was going to be killed. I'm not kidding. I had like a Rosemary's Baby fantasy that they had brought me this close and now were going to kill me. So that I would never publish my book, they would never let me do it, because I had gotten into the archive, and now... There you go. So they were going to kill me. So, you know, this may be the only paper that's ever given. Because they're going to kill me because I'm in the archive. And they won't give me. In other words, so the precise answer is to know exactly, because first they didn't have E-ticket, A-ticket. They didn't have the A to E structure. They introduced it later. They had real money at different rides, if you can believe it. They had an entry price, then they had real money. When exactly, I mean, they'll say, I can get like a date when they introduce this structure, but wouldn't it be great? I mean, I'm a historian. I, you know, and with the Musée Grévin, I had all of this material, the minutes of the meetings. Well, we don't like this, we don't like that. That's what I want for Disney. I'm there all the time saying, look, I need the park operations files. They're like, you can't have them. They don't exist. Can I have them or don't they exist? We don't do this. You can't. Trust me, I've been to Snow White building, that's like the, you know, Venturi building. I've tried everything. The archivist hates you, you know, Vanessa, you can't sit next to her. I know, because I was in Snow White building, yes. Anyway, I mean, it's crazy town. So the point is, Holly, you're right. Now, of course, there are no, you just have one entry fee, right? And unlike Universal Studios, except for a very, very small number of secret people, actually everybody pays the same price to get into Disneyland, and there's no VIP treatment. Yes, at Universal, you can like pay $200 and get on the fast line. But everybody at Disneyland gets on the same line. And now there's no A ticket, B ticket, C ticket. When that came in and when they realized this is all, and I have had some luck with Buzz Price's files, which are given to the Orlando Central Florida University. And I've had a student, James, James's last name? Ski, thank you. James Ski, who was my undergraduate at USC, who then went on to get a PhD at Berkeley in kind of American history of science and technology. And James has written his dissertation on Harrison Price. And he used his files in Central Florida. And there, because he did all of Disney's research, you know, his statistical stuff, you can get some material from his work on what they were thinking about when, but he also, there's a lot of lawsuits. Anyway, it's a long story. But that's the best way into some of this material, but it's, so I can't really answer it. Yeah, and it would be important to. But this is my point, by the way, about Disneyland. And I will also say publicly, because this gets at some of what Todd was underlying about critique, let me say right now to everyone in this room, I will not be able to reproduce one image, publish one word that I got from the Disney Archive without the Walt Disney Corporation approving what I write. And by the way, I told them that was fine. Because there's no choice. Otherwise, there will be no research into this topic. Now, luckily, I'm not there to say they're Nazis. I'm not interested in that. That's not my thing. You know, I'm not going to Disneyland to say it's imperialist, it's racist, whatever. Other people can do that. I'm interested in this aesthetic issue about motion, which is what I've said to them. I'm like, you people can't pay me enough to write this book, is what I've tried to say to them. Because I am a legitimate scholar who actually thinks what you do is interesting. Let me into your archive. They still won't. Can you believe it? And they're going to kill me. So, you know, but in any event, you have to know that, because this is really a problem. And you all know, because you've worked with artists, their families, you're complicit too, but you're not honest about it. I'm not kidding. All of you deal with the artists, their foundations, their whatever. You do it all the time and then act like it's not true. I am telling you, Disney is going to approve what I write or it won't be published. They will kill me or sue me. Okay. Because I can't hurt Mickey Mouse. He's money. He's a brand. And so is Calder, and so is Koons, and so is everybody that you all write about who's a fine artist, too. It's true. Brian.
I'm going to ask you a question now. I'm going to have to circle back around to the cars, but I don't want, I'm not asking you actually to say that the cars are bad, but I do want to know more about Disney's attitude about the cars, because you've described, because it seems to me that Disney doesn't think cars are great. He thinks that they're a necessary evil at best, right? And what you've described here as a fantasy, right, the jet age fantasy, I want to ask you to unpack the fantasy a little bit and the relationship between the fantasy and the reality, because the fantasy, as you've described it, is that that motion was fluid and painless, but of course we know that flying's not painless, driving's not painless, waiting in traffic isn't painless. And the thing that underwrites all of this, right, which is cheap oil, is not painless either, right? And what Disney seems to imagine for the future, if you take Epcot as the model, is a world that is kind of what today's architects imagine as the future in a world without energy, right? Which is a future in which movement won't be in cars, right? It'll be in people movers, right? That it'll be efficient, right? And so you use this word efficiency a lot, right? What's the relationship between that efficiency and the possibilities that cheap oil create for this kind of, you know, fluid world that is in fact not painless at all, but pretends to be not painless through this aestheticization of a kind of mobility that is a fantasy, in fact, that is not reality?
Well, what's really interesting, so that's a really good question, Brian, and what's really interesting is, like, when you look at the front of Small World, you know, the wonderful Tower of the Winds, the Tower of the Four Winds, which is a kind of kinetic mobile. It's by Raleigh Crum. And it's in front of Small World, which is, of course, boat-driven. what I would say, I mean, you're making me think two things. One is, so that's all about wind. But there's no consciousness there, I would say, self-consciously, about that source of power. And you're making me think that in all of the material that I've read by anybody, no one is saying anything about the source of energy. And there's no, you know, what's really interesting is, like, the whole carbon footprint thing about airplanes, nothing. And the environmentalists are only talking about noise. Airports are about noise, not about carbon footprint, about oil, about anything. So it's really interesting to me. And of course, there's a celebration of Edison. Disney wants to create Edison Square. So they love electricity. They love electricity. So Holly, that's for you. Electricity. They love, and GE, right? So they're big friends with GE. So I guess I would, so that's also electricity. I think I would say, who are they in bed with? Electric companies. Right. What's that? But that's so much later. I mean, it's interesting. I should think about that. But that's because they're a big company. I mean, I think what I would say is, in this period, I mean, you're making me think, there is no discussion. Electricity is where it's at. There's a lot of light. There's a lot of Edison, GE. Everything is run with gas. You're absolutely right that Disney believes, and I think this goes back to Todd's point about cars, Disney himself is absolutely for agglomerating. You know, he wants everyone to park their car and get on his kind of, you know, internalized, you know, his internal transport system. He really believed in hubs and in getting people out of their own car. That he really did. And so in that way, he's creating. That's what Epcot was. That's what Mineral King is. And the irony is that the environmentalists stopped Mineral King, right? But Mineral King would have been like Zermatt. He loved Switzerland. Says a lot. He loved Switzerland, and he was always going there and finding out these new ideas. And one was to go to Zermatt. Who's been to Zermatt? Anyone been to Zermatt? No, I've been to Zermatt. So you go to Zermatt. You know, the train stops. There's no cars in Zermatt. You have to go there, and it's all piéton. You know, you have to walk around. The train goes, and then that's it. And, you know, you take the little crazy train up to the Matterhorn. That's why the Matterhorn's in Disneyland, because he went to Zermatt. In any event, so there is this kind of hub idea that you kind of end up in a community that's more, I guess, communist, end up, you know, with hubs, and that's where efficiency comes in. But I think, Brian, what's interesting is there's no discussion of energy sources. So you're making me think this is a moment, and I think this is something that's hard for us to think about. These people are not thinking about scarcity. This is not a world of scarce resources, and this is not a world where people are conscious of scarce resources. It's 1953, 4, 5. So maybe that was a mistake, but, you know, it's not what they're thinking. At least, you know, au revoir.
Yeah. Vanessa, thank you very much for a great talk. I'd like to return to the issue of ergonomics, and especially ergonomics in the sense that, especially for airports, they imply that people have, you know, can be somewhere else as speedily as possible. So, you know, and we sort of experience something that is seamless, supposedly. I know we all know it doesn't work, but, you know, that's the idea. So how do you factor in the fact that in theme parks, on the contrary, in Disneyland, you're not going anywhere? It's directionless somehow. So how do you bring together, you know, the sort of directionless ergonomics, you know, and the phenomenology of all this?
Okay, that's a great... So that is an important question. Twofold. In other words, in Disneyland, if in the jet age... you actually are going somewhere. It is a real journey, after all, isn't it? And in Disneyland, you're actually not. Isn't it just kind of going around in circles or going nowhere? So is it in a simulation? Isn't it, you know, something that's not like, aren't these two things totally different? I would say two things about that. The first, and I'll answer later about the occlusion issue. the first is that I think that it's an aesthetic experience. In other words, that's why I'm calling it an aesthetic experience, and that I think that we want to both separate and not separate the aesthetic experience from the idea that at the airport you're also actually going somewhere. Do you see what I mean? That I think that, and yet that doesn't mean, A, that they don't share something, and this is important, and that they shouldn't share something. So I would say that it isn't that Disneyland is imitating the airport, but that's what I mean by jet age aesthetics, and that you don't have to, the trip doesn't have to have an end point, and that circulation prepares you for this.
So somehow it anticipates on something that was theorized much later, which is the experience economy in the 80s, you know, that shift from instrumentalization, sort of Taylorism, productivism, and, you know, consumerism as an end to itself, you know, the experience economy rather than, you know, going anywhere. It's just, you know, sort of self-enclosed.
Well, my argument is actually that it anticipates the idea of the internet, of surfing without going anywhere. I mean, that's really my argument, is that it makes you understand why you would have a media culture of the internet, which instead of talking about materiality and immateriality, is talking about circulation, endless circulation. So that's, if you want to understand what's the actual genealogy, to me the argument does become why Disneyland produces subjects who can experience the internet. And actually, you know, so Pokemon Go is, to me, where this leads, as I say, until you, like, literally walk yourself off the cliff, that there is a kind of actual world physics or metaphysics that challenges this logic, which is kind of like why when you're really in the airport it's slow, or why you fall off a cliff when you're playing Pokemon Go, that there is some materiality in the world that challenges our fantasy of Disneyland or our fantasy of Pokemon Go. So I think that would be what I would argue. But I do want to say one other thing about airports, because everyone always likes to say, and it's crowded in Disneyland and you can't get through the airport. Before 1967, before terrorism, the airport was a different place. Before terrorism and before the jumbos, before the 747 and before terrorism, there was not security in the airport. And anyone who still flies private or flies in small airports knows that, in fact, if you walk on, you know, I used to fly in Cape Cod. So, you know, in a little 27-seat airplane, you do just get on the airplane, get off the airplane. If you've flown in Latin America, Costa Rica, who's anyone flown in, like, the Costa Rica? You know, you just get on the airplane. I mean, it really is like, here's the airport, here's the airplane, get on, get off. Okay, it was more like that than you think up until, you know, the terrorists, the first set of terrorists, as you may recall, weren't putting airplanes into buildings. They were diverting, you know, in Entebbe and wherever else, Cuba, and, you know, that was a specialité, was the airplane. And that's when security, when the airport became a place that had no fluidité. So that's really the story of when the airport changed. So
thank you. Yeah, Robin, we can have more questions. Sorry. So now we have 10 minutes coffee break, and okay. Then we'll have the round table. I'm sorry, but we have no more room.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Completed her dissertation at L'Arca Paris Diderot 5 years ago in 2012, and merci. And who is now assistant professor at Université de Franche-Comté. And it is very timely that we have Hélène here because this book, which is her book out of her dissertation, Nuit américaine, l'art du nocturne aux États-Unis, 1890-1917, and it's a book that Holly in particular knows well because she was quite involved in this dissertation work, the dissertation work that was the basis for this book. So this book just keeps getting prizes. First of all, it was selected to be published at the Presse Universitaire de Paris-Sorbonne dans la collection Americana, which is a rare honor in itself. Then it received the prize, the Yale Terra Foundation Prize for a translation of a foreign book in American art history, and it's going to be therefore translated and published by Yale University Press next year.
It's coming out next year, yes.
Yes, it's already translated, I guess, yes. And just this weekend, we heard that this same book received another prize. This was announced at the Festival de l'Histoire de l'Art, the Olga Frades Prize for a book by a French art historian. What are the conditions for this prize?
The author needs to be under 40.
Under 40, okay, so I couldn't compete. yeah, right, she's the only one, right. So, congratulations, and I should say also that Hélène has been was this year the fellow, the postdoctoral fellow who did the Terra Paris Diderot Paris Nanterre seminar in American art history with students from our master's programs, and her class was on realism in American art. So, and my dear colleague Catherine Bernard is professor of English literature and art history at Paris Diderot. Her research hinges on the history of forms and aesthetics, as well as the politics of form and modernity from modernism to contemporary aesthetics. She has published extensively on modernist and contemporary visual culture and art, from the Bloomsbury Group to Andy Warhol, David Hockney, Gillian Waring, Rachel Whitehead, Sam Taylor Johnson. And her research has also attended to 20th and 21st centuries British literature, especially Virginia Woolf, which the work of which of whom she has contributed to translating and republishing in a recent Gallimard Pléiade and Folio edition, where she did especially the selection of essays, but that is an old passion of Catherine. She has also worked on Martin Amis, Graham Swift, and others. Sorry?
You can skip that.
Well, it's okay. And she is currently working towards a monograph on the body politics of contemporary British fiction and visual arts to be published in 2018, as well as a collective book essay out of the research that is done in our group, which is tentatively at least called New Objects of Visibility, and which is about very contemporary forms of visibility or objects of visibility. So Catherine will talk more specifically about the very contemporary, the ultra-contemporary aspects of our topic, and so she will speak last. I wanted to just very simply reintroduce a couple of trends that predate and oppose the currently widely accepted paradigm of circulation as a structuring factor of the history of American art. Those two trends, of course, we've already talked about them briefly, so I will be brief. Christian reminded us of them yesterday. And the first of the, so it's nativism and modernism. The first one, nativism, I just want to illustrate because I suspect that especially for younger generations, it is something that is increasingly becoming totally unknown. Because if you look at current texts in American art history, and I brought the absolutely remarkable volume American Encounters, edited by Angela Miller, Janet Berlow, Brian Wolfe, and Jennifer Roberts, called American Encounters, you would be hard put to find a trace of this once dominant current of thought in American art history and American studies, which is what I'm roughly and broadly referring to as nativism. So I just want to give a couple of illustrations of this trend, which, as Christian said very well last night, basically responds to the notion that American art and American culture are not born of interactions with other contexts or horizons, but are born of essentially environmental factors, forces. And of course, first, not the only one, but first and foremost among them is the land. Now, the land can be construed in different ways, but I use the term the land rather than landscape or nature or territory because it sort of combines all of that. So I just want to give a first example, and this will be very quick. This is from William Dunlap, who is is widely regarded as the first historian of American art. This is from the book History of the Rise and Progress of the Arts of Design in the United States. It's 1834, and this is just the very beginning of the book. I don't know if you can see, but I'll just read. It's very simple. It's about a. This is the first chapter. Happens to be about a relatively little-known painter and draftsman called Charles Robert Leslie, and the. Almost the first point that is made by Dunlap is that his father and mother were Americans, that they visited England, but that this has nothing to do with the development of his art. And he has this sentence, "Our cousins of Great Britain, who are very willing to cozen us out of anything that might do us credit, have claimed Leslie as an Englishman, although his parents returned to their native country and carried the boy with them before he was 5 years old." Okay, and the next, he received his first instruction as a painter in America and imbibed his taste and love for the art before he left the country to study systematically in Great Britain. And so, and this kind of serves as a pattern for a lesson that is repeated over and over in the text about these early, Dunlap's history starts with the Revolution. In other words, it doesn't talk about art in colonial America. But so the argument is going to be repeated many times. And now, this is an argument that runs through the 19th century and the 20th century, and I'm skipping a whole century and a half to get to a text that is now completely forgotten, but is not so old. It's just from 1962. This is, and here's the Dover edition. This was a very current still text when I was growing up myself as a student of American art. And this is volume 3. Now, Flexner's History of American Painting does begin in the colonial period, in fact, very early on. And this is volume 3, so it's the last volume, which is called, subtitled, That Wilder Image, The Native School from Thomas Cole to Winslow Homer. And of course, that native school is really the core of the tradition of American painting, especially that is discussed by Flexner. The foreword of the volume, once again, repeats about the native school, a nativist argument, and it just begins like this. In the mid-19th century, painting was more popular in America than at any other time in our history. The interest was not inspired by the importation from abroad of already famous masters. The rage was for works of living American artists, etc. And I'm going to skip to the next page, where Flexner sums up what is going to be the book's argument in every chapter. Here, to achieve their objectives, the painters turned for inspiration less to fine arts traditions abroad than vernacular traditions at home. Most had begun their professional careers in their teens as craftsmen, engravers, sign painters, itinerant portraitists, etc. And then comes this statement, some of the most effective exemplars of the native school never went abroad. Those who did cross the ocean set out, even if quite young, not as raw students. They were practicing professionals, pleased with what they already possessed. They had no desire to be born again. They wished to use the aesthetic riches of Europe as a means for refining an already established American manner. If, on their return to the United States, they found they had been lured into serious deviations, they usually regarded this as a handicap and labored, in the presence of American nature and art, to overcome it. At no other time has our painting been, for better or worse, so original, so far from European attitudes and forms. And a last excerpt from this same text here at the bottom. At the middle of the page talks about landscape, which is, of course, the core of that native school. Landscape has always been local in origin, each artist laboring to express those aspects of nature he best knew and loved. And further below in this paragraph, the native school can be explained only secondarily through the influence of painters on painters, of pictures on pictures. The typical styles, even when they parallel developments abroad, were more the results of inventions individually and collectively made in response to broad environmental forces. And so if you want to understand American art history, do not use French eyeglasses. The Hudson River School of Landscapists was well underway before there appeared in France a similar movement devoted to rendering local landscape, Barbizon. If Barbizon can be compared, understood as an equivalent of the Hudson River School, that's another question. We could argue that the end in the sense of where it breaks of this nativist tradition is in the work of Barbara Novak, which is the 1970s, and which is still, there are two books by Novak. American Painting in the 19th Century is the second one. The other one is called American Landscape, or the Landscape in, or no, American Painting in Nature. I forget, I didn't bring it here, but and Novak actually already starts to very much rework this whole nativist pattern, but there's still the very prominent place of the land and nature as a sort of nurturing influence on American painting. This is just, so basically this is to say that in 1975, which is just 40 years ago, when I was not quite, but almost starting to be a student, this was still a very, very potent discourse. And I think for all of us here who have something to do with that generation, it's a very strong memory. And of course, now that has essentially completely subsided. And as I was saying, the pattern, the trend for a good 20, 25 years now has been towards internationalizing, globalizing, and we could say encountering, in a sense, the history of American art, that is to say, turning into a history of encounters and especially a history of encounters with not just Europe and the Atlantic, transatlantic pattern, but with all sorts of others, from especially inside North and South America. And so that this whole mode of narration focusing on the isolation from external forces and the sort of exclusion of circulation. I mean, if artists circulated, it was for non-essential reasons, essentially goes the native argument. That is just now, I think, something that is unthinkable. The other tradition that I just want to briefly remind us of, again, this is perhaps especially for the younger generations, and we've already alluded to this quite a bit yesterday, is the modernist tradition, and or rather, I should say, the Greenbergian, and actually this is even one aspect of Greenberg only, because you should be very careful of not generalizing too sweepingly here. In the Avant-Garde in Kitsch article, which is an amazing text for all sorts of reasons, it's really interesting to see that it's not just that Kitsch is what circulates or what moves. And you can see this quote here, "Kitsch has not been confined to the cities in which it was born, but has flowed out over the countryside, wiping out folk culture. Nor has it shown any regard for geographical and national cultural boundaries. Another mass product of Western industrialism, it has gone on a triumphal tour of the world, crowding out and defacing native culture in one colonial country after another, so that it is now, by way of becoming a universal culture, the first universal culture ever beheld." So it's not just that Kitsch, by definition almost, is art that moves, but it is also the fact that, and I don't have time to develop this, that art precisely, I mean, the opposite of Kitsch, that is to say the avant-garde, is something that does not move, that is outside of the realm of motion, because its primary function, the way it functions, the way the work of art of the avant-garde artist in its relation to a refined viewer is one that operates on a purely a spiritual, metaphysical, intelligible, or aesthetically, aesthetically full of the aesthetic effect is the result of an inward effort of the viewer to encounter the work of art and the artist. And there's this absolutely fascinating here, this fascinating comparison of Riepin, the Russian history painter, and Picasso, and on the notion of effect, the fact that Riepin is a painter who already delivers the effect for the masses so that they can be easily moved, whereas from Picasso, one has to work inward and through the painting, so to speak, in order to... But this effort is, once again, one that is construed as being a kind of face-à-face with the painting, which is what led me to suggest yesterday also that it is not entirely clear that the the fantasy or the mode of absolute perfect circulation of the picture of the work of art that is our perhaps one of our horizons today is actually not, I mean, it's in a sense perfectly compatible with this sort of binary face-à-face of the viewer with the work of art in the Greenberg, in this Greenberg argument. Now, there'd be a lot more to say about Greenberg, and I don't want to, especially about the political context of this essay and the fact that it's actually very nuanced. But I just wanted to bring this up to refresh us and to refresh the conversation. And I think I will just stop there because those were my talking points. And maybe just let Hélène take the floor here. So you want to?
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
So thank you, and I'm just going to transition to the other end. I just have a few remarks because I'm not going to repeat what I wrote in the collection. That's my student's work. Sorry. I wanted to come back to the digital. Because we, you know, all of us mentioned it before. Otherwise, I can do without the images, it's fine. The digital, not as, you know, a rupture, but more as a continuity of existing forms or ways of phenomenons, of ways of approaching images, and more of in terms of the acceleration and the intensification of those phenomenons. Part of the essay I wrote for the collection deals with the digital life of the portrait of Whistler's mother, and I was mentioning yesterday it's fine, don't worry. It's okay.
I'm still finding it.
Don't worry, it's fine. So I was mentioning the spoofs, the internet, you know. Reuses of the painting, and the way also today the institutions still participate in that movement of circulating images, with, you know, taking the risk also of going against perhaps more scholarly approaches to the works. And I just taught a class with my colleague Pauline Chevalier about museums in a digital age, and we were, you know, showing students how, for instance, it's not the same people in museums who deal with, you know, curation scientific work and then on the other hand put things online, while at the same time going digital and involving, you know, engaging, circulating the works with the online, engaging with a new form of audience has become really the primary concern of most institutions. So we've shown examples to students of, you know, applications and games and interactive tools that people try to design to circulate the works, and we were questioning the problems that we also raise in terms of a traditional approach to the work. So that's one thing. Maybe we could also discuss the institutions and their own relation to that kind of circulation as well. Also, someone in the I think it was Wilco mentioned that images online tend to disappear faster, and that's something also we worked a lot on archives, again with Pauline, online archives, and it seems counterintuitive, but the circulating on the internet is also a form of non-circulation because it's a very ephemeral kind of circulation, and things don't stay on the internet. So it's a form of disappearance in a way. And also, I'm also thinking of, you know, new forms of circulation being, we talked about censorship yesterday, but new forms of circulation preventing communication or circulation. The example I had in mind was this movie, I forget the title, that was presented at Cannes but could not compete for the Palme d'Or because it's on Netflix. So also, you know, perhaps we could interrogate how certain forms or circuits of circulation prevent or are, you know, hermetic towards one another. one question that was important also in the essay was that of national belonging, and I guess it comes back to this idea of, you know, the native or the national identity as, you know, formative of the work of art. And I think, you know, first of all, in the context of the Terra Foundation, this is a very relevant question, but there's a common thread, obviously, in most of the talks on displacement, translation, being out of place also, you know, being something you don't want to see or being something you cannot see. And one interesting thing I'd like perhaps to discuss with you would be the resistance to that displacement or to that transfer, again, as a form of non-circulation. And finally, just talking about circulation, proliferation of images online, I would like just to come back to the title that Wilco chose yesterday, the porn, that word porn, because for me, it's really an internet word, because of course you think of pornography, but riot porn, food porn, you know, you almost want to put a hashtag in front of that word. And to me, it indicates something about the way images circulate, of their nature too, but, you know, there's something shameful and then something clandestine about the circulation. They're exploitative, but they're also, it's a circulation by proxy. So there's also the question of the involvement of the spectator in the consumption of those images. And perhaps also the passivity of the spectator. And that maybe also can be seen in the examples given by Vanessa Schwartz this morning. I was struck, for instance, that by the idea that Walt Disney, who was so, you know, he was so interested in studying the movement of the human body in Snow White, then he ends up putting people on transporting lines as if they were objects themselves. So there's also the circulation of the spectator himself, right? So I'll leave this that way, just, you know, to maybe start a few conversations. These are the things I'd like to discuss with you, basically. And then I'll let Catherine move on.
Okay, thank you very much, Hélène. I'd like to thank once again François and all our colleagues at the Terra Foundation for such a wonderful symposium. That was just incredible. And thank you very much for inviting me, although I'm not an Americanist. Apologies. You know, I'm a representative of the former colonial, you know, nation, you know, power, so I'm sorry. So although not Americanist, I've been working, as François very kindly pointed out, I've been working quite extensively on contemporary visual culture, and more specifically on the new practices developed by and around that new, supposedly new, visual culture. And I'm currently, yes, editing a volume that is, I think, will be entitled New Objects of Visibility. I haven't found a better title, in which we'll have articles about these very, very contemporary practices, ranging from movie trailers binge-watching to Google Earth photographs, with a wonderful article by Chiara Solari in the volume. So all these practices, which so far haven't really attracted any kind of critical interest, and that's very interesting. I think it has to do with the sort of illicit and, you know, loathsome aspect of these practices, in the sense that they haven't been, you know, fully considered as sort of worthy, you know, anthropological objects, and that's very interesting. I'd like to start first by sort of, you know, sort of looping and going back full circle and return to the title of François's introduction in the volume. So, No Representation Without Circulation. For a long time, actually, I read No Circulation Without Representation. And I had started, you know, thinking about my talk today, my few words, you know, sort of, you know, steered towards that relatively, I would say, sort of canonical way of looking at circulation and representation. You know, no circulation without representation, fine, okay. I thought, okay, you know, canonical conception of the localism of representation. And then I thought, yeah, no, that's not François, you know, that's too easy. Maybe I should, you know, check again. And of course, it wasn't no circulation without representation, silly me. It was, of course, no representation without circulation. Much, much more interesting, obviously. And then I thought, oh, yeah, why is it so much more interesting then? Yes, of course it is more interesting, because it implies that somehow representation must depart from the object and from the grounded context of the image. To fully achieve a form of truthfulness, it must somehow move away in order to come back and be fully representative. So as if somehow, as if only if and when they circulate, may images be fully somehow mimetic. Only if and when they circulate can they finally circle back to their origin. And I find that very interesting. You know, they need to circle back to the point of departure, to the object of departure, the context and subject. Only if and when they circulate may images function as currency, which is one of the central metaphors of the introductory chapter. It's a paradox on which François elaborates in his introduction. So what is happening, in other words, to this movement back, to this circulation, to this circularity, to the revolution that is achieved by images, and especially in the very, very contemporary context of the web. Now, obviously, visual semiosis has become a very, very complex matter, as we have amply seen these last 2 days. Images circulate, as we know, they are remediated, they're culturally rebooted, they are acculturated. They become more and more what has been defined as glocal, horrible coinage, glocal. Every time I use the word with my students, they think, ooh, she has a problem, you know, a glocal, you know, the glocality of images. Now, it's a coinage which was taken up and elaborated on by, as you know, Arjun Appadurai in 1996 in Modernity at Large. But actually, if you go back to the origin of that coinage, glocalism, it first appeared in the 80s. And it was first introduced in, of all places, the Harvard Business Review. Interesting. And it was introduced by Japanese economists to describe precisely the supposedly new stage of capitalism, that is, that moment of juncture between the global and the local. Okay. I find it interesting that it should have been introduced not by American economists, but by Japanese economists, okay, who were obviously writing under the aegis, if you want, of the American global economic power. So images become, as we know, cultural hybrids, okay, this is well known, in which the global and the local are entangled. I will return to that metaphor, which has been used repeatedly these last 2 days, entanglement, entangled, and Vanessa took it up this morning as well. So images are brought into a complex sort of dialectical relation by bringing together global images, the global language of images, and their local appropriation. I'll just take one tiny example. John Woo's 1997 Face Off, which is, of course, a rebooted Western, a martial arts movie, what's called in Chinese, I hope there are no Chinese speakers in the room, you know, the Wuxi Pan tradition, which, and that's obviously, that's, you know, characteristic of Hong Kong and the fact that Hong Kong movie directors moved then to Hollywood. John was a very good example. So a mixture of, you know, Western, martial arts movie, cop movie, etc. But then if you look at the movie closely and all the tradition that John Woo initiated, then you start thinking, okay, who's rebooting who? Which culture is actually rebooting which culture? Okay, is it Hong Kong? Is it the Hong Kong film industry sort of revisiting, reinventing Hollywood, or the other way around, as most critics would argue? You know, what sense of direction does Face Off achieve
east, west, back and forward, okay? Which genre remediates which genre as well, okay? And I think that's one of the crucial questions which we need to ask ourselves today, you know. How does the globalization and the glocalization of images impact the way we receive them? And impact the way we receive them depending on the context. Obviously, Face Off, you know, if you watch it in Los Angeles, in Paris, in Hong Kong, in Shanghai, in Africa, won't have the same effect. And I think we need to remember this, because somehow we tend to adhere probably too much to this notion that images have become global, full stop, okay? That they circulate endlessly and seamlessly, something which was touched upon before as well. So I would argue that there is no cultural face-off, but the sort of, you know, constant revamping of visual and dramatic references, traveling across borders, okay? Endlessly exchanging appearances and identities, and in that sense, John Woo's movie is a fantastic allegory of the status of contemporary images. I won't have the time to go into the paradigm of allegory, but it seems to me that we also need to bear in mind how much allegorically we tend to think about images, okay? With form being allegorical of content and vice versa, and what I'm doing right now about the John Woo's adaptation of martial arts, of the martial arts genre, is allegorizing the film itself. So somehow what is fascinating about this constant circulation of contemporary images is the fact that they have become themselves sort of, you know, blueprint for their own interpretation in a global world, but a global world which needs also to accommodate the local. Very complex dialectics. So supposedly, okay, images are, you know, free-floating, surfing, caught in a sort of transborder circulation. They've been supposedly subsumed under a sort of seamless metaphorical regime without points of departure and arrival. Now, this is not new. Interestingly, Roland Barthes, of all people, was there before. And very, very early on, in a text which I turned back to prepare that roundtable, in 1971, in an interview with, of all people, Guy Scarpetta, who was, you know, one of the sort of gurus of structuralism. In 1971, in an interview entitled Digression, he somehow speaks up for the necessity to what he called désoriginer l'image, désoriginer la métaphore. And he insists that we need somehow to accept that images, language, words needs to be unleashed, freely floating, okay, somehow anticipating many, many of the analyses carried out today in relation to images. And I'm quoting Barthes. Il nous faut employer le plus de métaphores possible, car les métaphores est la voie d'accès au signifiant. À défaut d'algorithme, I'm not inventing it, he uses the word algorithm, it's amazing. À défaut d'algorithme, c'est elle qui peut donner congé au signifié, surtout si on parvient à la désoriginer. And when I reread that passage, I thought, algorithm, you're kidding. You know, Barthes had already anticipated on the present somehow, and the sort of paradigm of the algorithm, and I thought that was fantastic. So yes, somehow, we need to make sense, as Barthes already suggested in 1971, we need to make sense of the language of images, language at large, when it has become disoriginated. And this is somehow the only answer we may bring, we may, you know, give to the algorithmic world. He, in that essay, it's a fantastic essay in which he opposes the mathematical vision of the world, which is why he uses the paradigm of algorithm, and the metaphorical transporting vision, okay, or conception or experience, if you want, of language. So algorithms as opposed to the free circulation, the disoriginated circulation of images. I won't go into the current debates, which is really raging right now, about the filter bubble, the algorithm, you know, industry, and the way, obviously, algorithms also filter our access to images, which is something which we tend to overlook, okay, and which we need if we work on contemporary visual culture, which we need, and especially on digital contemporary culture, which we constantly need to bear in mind. Okay, what comes up in my request to Instagram will be very different from what comes up in your requests. Okay, so that our access to this supposedly global world of images is somehow caught in a very, very complex series of filters, okay, which we constantly need to remind ourselves are there, sort of, you know, hinging, if you want, our supposedly free access to that supposedly free-floating world of images. There's a fantastic essay by Ellie Pariser, The Filter Bubble, published in 2011 on that issue. Now, what I'd like to turn very briefly to is the way all this has displaced some of the main metaphors which we had been using before in order to talk about the way images enter in a dialogue with each other, the way visual cultures enter in dialogues with each other. Now, the essential chronotope, which we have been so used to ever since modernism, you know, the before and post, you know, the post paradigm, but not only that, but also the geography of center and periphery, so the geographics, if you want, of visual analysis, but also the topographics of all this has been displaced. You know, the topographics in the sense that we still now talk about the layering of references. Okay, so the geography, the topography, the diachrony of metaphorical language and the language we use when we talk about images. All this has been displaced, especially in very, very, very recent talk about images. Now, interestingly, what has come up are images that are borrowed from the world of physics. Entanglement is a world which initially was used and is still used by physicists, but also biology. You talked a lot about growing, you know, growth. I'm quite struck by the fact that whereas before, you know, within the modernist paradigm, we talked about before and after, you know, now we talk, you know, we try to find models borrowed very often from world physics and life sciences to talk about the entanglement of images and the entanglement of our visual culture. Ray Cho in 2012, of course, in her groundbreaking essay, Entanglements or Transmedial Thinking About Capture, probably was one of the first ones to hint, you know, at this move from one kind of metaphors to another one. And I just wanted also to mention a really remarkable collection of essays published by Leuven University Press last year in 2016, edited by Brianne Cohen and Alexander Streitberger, The Photofilmic in Contemporary Art and Visual Culture, in which, once again, they insist on that metaphorical shift from geography or diachrony to entanglement and metaphors borrowed from life sciences. Now, in the field of contemporary art and contemporary aesthetics, which is much more my field, what's interesting as well is that this has forced critics to move on even beyond what is still today one of the most structuring paradigm which we have in contemporary art, the expanded field, you know, the Rosalind Krauss paradigm of the expanded field of art, okay? And precisely, our new visual culture imposes us to move on, you know, beyond the expanded field, as if, you know, that metaphor was not enough anymore, to turn to an approach to images that is much, much more pragmatic, okay? And I was about to ask you, Vanessa, a question about the phenomenology of all this, you know, the pragmatics, the corporeality of all this, which I think we really need still to take into account, much, much more probably than we do. Now, that move away from geology, geography, you know, implies also, and that's another important element in criticism, a turn from medium to format. And this is crucial. A turn from medium to format. Because what that entails is obviously a turn away from the aesthetic scaffolding inherited from modernism, okay? Greenberg, obviously, you know, medium specificity, you know, truth to the medium, all that stuff. You were, you know, Vanessa sort of ironically alluding to, you know, the architectural, you know, sort of fascination and fixation on the medium. Yes, and that's what is really striking is the way critics today tend to disentangle themselves from that history to find other modes of entanglement, if you want. And what they do is precisely emphasize the specificity of format and the sort of the practice, once again, the phenomenology which new formats impose on us. At the juncture, once again, of the technological, obviously, the aesthetic, the formal, and the political, or the ideological, which is why allegory is also interesting. Now, this is central to David Joselit's latest collection of essays, After Art. He sticks to the post-paradigm, but nevertheless. Joselit, who tries to somehow make do with the limitations, if you want, of the metaphors used in the field of contemporary art to talk about all this. And it's obviously a sort of, a sequel to another collection of essays published in 2007, Feedback, Television Against Democracy. In Feedback, the titles of the chapters already, I think, are very telling. Open Circuits, Virus, Feedback, and Avatar. Now, in his latest collection of essays, he insists much, much more on formats. And I like to quote from the passage devoted to formats. Formats are dynamic mechanisms for aggregating content. In mediums, a material substrate, such as paint or canvas, converges with an aesthetic tradition, such as painting. Ultimately, mediums lead to objects and thus reification. But formats are nodal connections and differential fields. They channel an unpredictable array of ephemeral currents and charges, electricity, or at least electricity once again. They are configurations of force rather than discrete objects. In short, formats establish a pattern of links and connections, entanglements, in other words, unquote. Now, recent research on format, and especially on the phenomenology of digital formats, legitimately, I think, calls for a more materialistic reading of this shift from medium to format. And I was very interested yesterday in the discussion that came up about and around materialism and the various forms of materialism, the technological materialism, this sort of, superstructure, materialistic apparatus, etc. So, materialism. And I think we still need somehow to work on this interaction of different forms of materialism in our contemporary visual culture. What we need to do, of course, and that will be my last remark, is to accept that, yes, we need to work, or some of us, if we're interested in this, we need to work on what the artist and theoretician Hitto Steil has defined as the poor image. Not the bad image, the poor image, l'image pauvre, okay, the poor image. In a 2009 essay entitled The Poor Image, Hitto Steil, which was reproduced in a collection entitled Beyond Representation, Steil insists on the necessity for critics, specialists of aesthetics, etc., to turn to the poor image with this insistence that it's a sort of, almost sort of, political necessity. We shouldn't leave the ground, to other, theoreticians or people working with the poor image. We should somehow reclaim the poor image for theory. And she explains, the poor image is a copy in motion. Its quality is bad. Its resolution substandard. As it accelerates, it deteriorates. It is a ghost of an image, a preview, a thumbnail, an errant idea, an itinerant image distributed for free, squeezed through low digital connections, compressed, reproduced, ripped, remixed, as well as copied and pasted into other channels of distribution. And she adds, the poor image is no longer about the real thing, the original. It is instead about its own real conditions of existence, about swarm circulation, digital dispersion, fractured and flexible temporalities. It is about defiance and appropriation, just as it is about conformism and exploitation. In short, it is about reality. Now, one may, of course, wonder, has there been a time when modern images were not poor? Okay. Postcards, stamps, you know, has there been a time when images were sort of rich? Okay, that's a disturbing thought. Of course not. But what Steil insists on is precisely, if you remember her quote, the link between the poor image and the swarm circulation. That's what is crucial. The crowd nature of the image, okay? The sort of tsunami effect of images today. And what she insists on in her essay is the necessity to bring together the sort of substandard, you know, poor image, and the fact that somehow today we have a sort of mass relation to images, okay? We are part of a crowd, you know, confronted with a crowd of images, a swarm of images. And of course, this entails a very specific form of visual literacy. And ultimately, it entails a very, very specific form of visual democracy as well, in what could be defined as a sort of glocalized police, okay, or political body. Now, this is, for instance, what Didier Huberman insists on in his latest installment of his ongoing L'œil de l'histoire, okay, number 6, if I'm correct, in which he precisely very much insists on le peuple, okay, et le peuple des images, and all the demotic emotions that go with that, you know, that le peuple des images. And I'm reaching my conclusion here. So what Steil or Joselite tried to do somehow with other critics, of course, is to rethink, you know, the sort of paradigm of remediation, to try and bring it together with another paradigm that has increasingly come up in recent thoughts, the paradigm of the common, the paradigm of the demotic, and the paradigm of the multitude. The multitude, as of course Hart and Negri understand it, but also as the Italian philosopher Paolo Viano understands it in his great essay published in 2014, A Grammar of the Multitude. And what I would like to suggest simply to conclude is that maybe for those of us working, you know, on highly, highly contemporary culture, especially digital visual culture, our task today is still to find the right way or the sort of apposite way to talk about, you know, or to find, you know, the sort of underlying grammar of the swarm image or of this multitude of images. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Catherine. I suspect that we should probably move directly to questions and discussion with the audience instead of commenting on each other. I'll just a number of different points have been raised, and I think there's much to reflect on here. I have plenty of ideas of questions that I want to raise, but sure that others too. Yes. Good.
I have a comment or like a comment and maybe a question that relates to what Hélène and Catherine said. I was thinking about the digitization of images in museums and that you mentioned, and also then the it seems to me that it's a contemporary focus on digitization of images that circulate on the internet. And I was thinking about basically the two things that with the digitization of a collection, basically, and the idea that images should circulate freely on the internet, there's a question of connection between the material form of these images and their circulation, right? And I think it connects both to contemporary art practices when we think about a lot of visual culture and what's available on the internet, what's disseminated on the internet. But when artists, they work with digital images, then they do process them into material forms to be on the art market. And these material forms, in some ways, have to be circulated, but also have to be kept from circulating in order to survive. So that connection between the artwork, its digitization, I think that every photographic process right now used by contemporary artists have to take, even when they take a physical form, they do get processed through digital machines. However, one of their big concerns after that is how to preserve them, right? And so the digitization, on the other hand, of artworks that already exist need to circulate in order to remain relevant. And so the digitization process is kind of a reversed from their unique existence in one place, let's say, to be part of the current culture, right? And I was wondering if you had any comments about that.
Well, to me, it's not really a new question in that we already had the same kind of interrogation about performance, for instance, how to preserve performance, how to create archives of the performance, how different that was from the real performance, how can you multiply the performance arts. So I think it's interesting that, I guess the question is, again, you know, in the internet accelerates or intensifies or, you know, spreads the question wider, but it was already a concern, and it's more a question of, dealing with different kinds of mediums. But again, since, you know, the very beginning, we've had to confront those questions, the translations of question. And to come back to what you were saying about, you know, this need to preserve and give a material form, I've always found, like, since we've been talking about 3D printing, for me, 3D printing is such an antiquated medium in a way. It's a return of the old in a way. So it's really striking for me. And maybe that, you know, we can talk about resistance. There is something about us that wants to preserve and conserver, really, the objects, and there's maybe definitely a fetishism about the materiality, and I guess that's something also we didn't really mention in your example, the book as an object. We were talking about that this morning with someone else, the book as itself a material object that you touch and leaf through and has its own materiality, and that we would be attached to in a certain way. So I don't know if you...
I think that the issue of the archive is absolutely crucial, both to the way we theorize our access to images right now, and because somehow, as Hélène just suggested, it's for anyone working on highly, highly contemporary visual culture and on formats, it's obvious that this is a completely archaic notion. I mean, it's completely useless to understand how digital images work and how especially the main platforms of images function. Because this change constantly. So there is no... I mean, it's very, very difficult to stabilize the archive somehow. Anyone who's been doing any kind of work on Instagram and using Instagram as both a format to reflect on, an object, a source, etc., will know that the only thing you can do is make as many screen captures as you can.
That's what people do.
Yeah, yes. Precisely. So produce your own archives of what is already supposed to be a form of archive, a form of a source, if you want. So I think that what we, for anyone working on highly contemporary images and visual culture, what you need to do is once again factor in the instability of the archive. And the fact that, you know, we're always talking about a state of the archives that will be different 2 hours later or even 15 minutes later. And I think that this is something which we need to approach, which we need to, once again, factor in. Now, some artists do. There's a fantastic exhibition of Wolfgang Tillmans right now at Tate Modern. And Tillmans precisely reflects on the instability of the source, on the fact that his own image, his own take on images will shift, you know, depending on the context, depending on the printing process, depending on the size of the image, etc. So using somehow the instability of digital archives in order as a somehow as an object, if you want. Now, let me make myself clear. I'm not talking about the actual, you know, digital official archives of, I don't know, les archives, you know, de Paris or whatever. I'm talking about that ongoing, open, endless, you know, process of archiving that is currently the net to a great extent. So, and I think that we still need to find the right words, somehow the right concepts to talk about this. We haven't quite, I think, found them yet. Because precisely, I mean, we're caught in the hermeneutic circle. We're part of it, so it's really hard to find, you know, the right way of talking about this.
I really like the way that you call our attention to the terms that we invent to try to keep up with our ideas as we think about these issues. And I would agree that glocal is a particularly unfortunate one. And just one comment, and which kind of connects to remarks Francois made as well. I was thinking about that local versus global in an essay that I was writing on American exceptionalism, which is a slightly more political way, perhaps, to talk about the phenomenon of nativism that that Francois was discussing. And I came up with the dichotomy of place and space, place being rooted with stratum, more of a kind of geological concept, space, as you say, being more biological, fluid, about processes, thinking about the way things flow over surfaces. And in my essay, I wanted to find a way to recuperate some of the good that came out of the earlier scholarship that was based on the local, the regional, you might even say the provincial. And I found a term I liked a lot, actually, in an essay written over 50 years ago by, of all people, Sir Kenneth Clark, an essay on provincialism. And his term was micropolitan, trying to get at the local, but also at the polyglot, cosmopolitan nature of culture. And I think that that's, at least in the American concept, an interesting way to think about the U.S. not being a Galapagos island, a kind of bell jar of 300 years of development without any exterior influences, but also something that did happen in its local context despite its connection to the globe. So that's just one other term we might throw in there.
No, I thank you very much. I totally agree. And I think the micropolitan is a fantastic term, because obviously it somehow bridges the gap, you know, between the monist obsession with cosmopolitanism, obviously, and yes, I think that necessary turn back, maybe, I don't like the back, but you know, the sort of turn, the swing back to a very sort of Foucauldian, I've got a fixation on Foucault, a Foucauldian way of approaching, including archives, with this notion that, you know, the archaeology, the historicizing is an endless process, you know. But our way of approaching this needs to be tangential to it, you know, that we need to be as careful as we can in the way we use, you know, concepts, and in our capacity to historicize the concepts we use. And this is something which all my, you know, PhD students, I can see some of them, you know that I'm also sort of fixate on. So yes, constantly historicizing the words we use, because they are precisely the ideological scaffolding which structures the way we look at images.
Certainly circulation is a word that is in need of historicization as well. And,
yeah.
I think Verle wants to ask a question.
I just wanted to say something about a certain kind of awareness that I've been having sitting in these conferences over so many years, and which you make clear very well, Catherine, and which is that over 15 years, in a way, with this internationalization of American art history, or art history as well, we felt we were doing things which were good, but it still had that sense of preservation in a way, or that it was that there's some that it didn't really collapse things. It was we go outward and we meet the other, and so the either the French center or the American center was kind of meeting the other and crossing borders, but in a way the core was still untouched to some extent. As in Vanessa's, you sit in your little ship or in your little boat, but you're safe, you're untouched, you see things and you're untouched. And I think what we are in now, that what Catherine shows is that actually it is fragmented in a way. It's only the format that you adopt which will bring in a certain temporary order. And so when you write the histories, it's maybe a little just distill or whatever you call it, but definitely I think the age of encounters and even the transmission of internationalizing sounds at this point a little naive, and it comes with what we heard in at the Tate in Liverpool. It comes with a notion of hindrance that actually the others are maybe not so open to encounters, or implosion is that the it's no longer clear what is there and what's safe and what's not safe, or what has shape and what hasn't. So it's no longer a form even. So it needs a format in order to at least be held for a moment so we can actually think about it and maybe find a word for it. So
I think you're going to make us cry.
No, I don't want to do that. It's just, in a way, it's a relief. I must say, personally, it's a relief.
Can I interject something? Because there's a few things I wanted to say and respond. First of all, one of the problems that I had to deal with in preparing the volume was to disconnect or open up the notion of circulation from its more specific and much more historically determined reading or construction in terms of nationality. Because so much has been done in the way of internationalizing American art, while at the same time, I think much of the time remaining committed to some kind of core thing about that has to do with that it is primarily interrogated in terms of nationality. Whether it's I'm taking nationality in a broad construction, and that is to say that includes minority identities and various communities. But the notion that certain types of objects and pictures and things are related to certain communities and the way they interact with other communities. And the trouble that the reason I thought this was necessary was because I think of the kinds of things that Catherine and Hélène were talking about, things like the displacement of various metaphors, maybe, or categories, particularly geographic and diachronic, and also, this displacement, I think, is inherent in a certain notion. And once again, I'm going back to the discussion that we already started yesterday. Is inherent to a certain state or a certain construction of this notion of circulation as something that is much more electric or cybernetic or working like a computer in on sort of a 0-1 alternative. For anything that circulates, there's something that doesn't circulate, and circulation is not continuous, and things disappear, and it's extremely difficult to keep archives, and so circulation is not, or at least must not be, thought of only in the sense of a sort of linear expansion of modes and abilities of transportation, and it's also something that is synchronic. And that works in a sort of grid where, you have an infinitely moving patterns of light coming on and off, and, where it's not like everything circulates at once together and goes into a bright future. So the question is, how do we? That is the condition of today, or at least of digital circulation, of how we experience it today. The question is, how does that apply or not apply, or how does it work or not work in order to write a history of the past? And one thing that really I find a big question is the notion, all this notion about the demotic or democratic, the question of the people of images and the people watching images. We have an increasing amount of research and studies and curiosity for the earlier stages, not just of mass industry of images, but the earlier stages of thinking or of writing, of working with this notion of mass images. Michael Lija has been working for 5 or 6 years on what he calls a flood of pictures, which is the title of his project, referring to the huge expansion of lithography and various forms of popular engraving, illustrated press in the 1830s. And so one of the questions that I find difficult is, because we are, at least I am, trying to do history. And of course, you also can claim that, you know, history is just not appropriate. That would be fine too, but that, you know, well, it wouldn't be fine, but I'm just saying that there are those people who you know, so how do we, what? How do we historicize such things? You know, that's a big question. And so, because you think about circulation, it's an old term that does actually in its one of its earliest occurrences actually include the notion of circling back to the origin, to the point of departure, which is of course interesting when you think about, you know, remediation and the way that, and the whole, you know, the whole Whistler painting story, how, you know, the painting goes abroad, gets enshrined in France, and comes back in reproduction in the U.S. and is something else. I mean, the same and not the same, and that's all very nice. But circulation as a term of the study of the media and you know, communication has really in the 20th century been primarily applied to the publishing industry and the press to indicate amounts of distribution, and so it's very ahistorical. To apply this concept to a long history of American art, especially, was problematic and still remains. And I think what everything we've heard just now sort of confirms this perplexity. It doesn't mean that we can't do anything, but it's anyway. So I think there was. I hope I didn't extinguish all aspirations to speak. Yes, Holly.
Well, I'm, of course, weeping and fallen into despair, but I'll try to pull myself together. I wanted to ask, Francois, you just touched on something that I wanted to raise, which maybe now I'll set aside. But so let me focus on something else. I'm very, very struck and sort of woken up and jarred whenever I hear reference to the contemporary swarm or tsunami of images, because one of the things that I'm not the first person to observe is that, in fact, par contre, we could actually evoke the swarm of words that we're all engulfed in now. I mean, for every, you know what I'm saying, for every Instagram, we're awash in SMS messages, so that in some ways, to say that it is always, as it were, always already an encounter with the visual when it is at least as frequent and as pressingly an encounter with a new swarm of words seems to me needs always to be said at the same time. And that also, those of us, a lot of people in this room are art history professors, And we are always thinking about, you know, there's always, it's income, at least over on the other side of the ocean, there's all this talk about whether or not we are or we are not on the barricades of fostering what sometimes is called visual literacy. So because I studied the 19th century, I'm also not alone in thinking that perhaps one of our primary, you might say, sort of vectors of potentially positive intervention is in fact within the vector of default temporalities, and in fact working in the direction of slowing down rather than sticking with the hectic speeding up of the spheres of circulation, especially Catherine that you were mentioning, but also Hélène, which is to say, everybody knows this, there has been a kind of pushback in the form of slow looking, which of course is an ironic to some degree mirroring of slow eating, right? But nonetheless, slow looking in some ways to, you know, in some ways to resist certain tides, and I mean literally literal tides and ideological and political tides. So, and this takes me to, so what about words? What about temporalities? And just a tiny riff on the important point that Francois just made. I was thinking of my friend Michael Legis' flood of pictures, but I've also been thinking about the incredibly important cognate work that Anne Higonet has done recently about the image vortex in 19th century Paris, how incredibly important it's been for those of us who dwell in those places to think perpetually about the palimpsestic and the intermedial and the struggle and the competition between and amongst image technologies. And I guess I wanted to ask, so what about all that? Is that sort of set aside and pushed to the margins by some of the comments that were made, or do you still think that that is in some ways core portions of the art history mission, whether it be of American visual culture or French visual culture or something else?
I don't know what Catherine or Hélène would say. I would like to, I think one of the problems is how do we, I mean, as first of all, as far as slow looking, I think you're entirely right, and this is what, you know, as Eric de Chassé said the other day at the Festival de l'Histoire de l'Art, introducing his very long speech, his first sentence was the best, when he said, "Our task is to teach and continue to teach the incredibly important and necessary task of learning to read images, reading pictures, and as complex as they are, and of course that has to be slow, and that is something that." You know, I think we more or less all agree on. And the second thing is about, yes, temporalities, precisely. Of course, when one is working on the hyper-contemporary, that may be a secondary concern, I'm not sure. But certainly if one is trying to, say, work about the contemporary in a broad sense, you know, since 1800, one has to try to build a narrative or narratives, and those narratives need to distinguish between different times. And this is precisely what I find increasingly difficult in these kinds of discussions, is the fact that the recession, the pressure of what I call digital culture, but that's too much too broad a term, and digital is a fake, I mean, is probably a misnomer, to swallow up, reproject itself into the recent past, you know, the past not of So we have a history of technology that's pretty secure, I mean, relatively speaking, but the history of spectacles, the history of visual experience, the history of practices of those demotic practices of looking and using images, that is very difficult, because that is to really create and maintain moments of change and rupture and evolution in that what can appear to an external eye as a sort of big continuum. Think about Régis Debray.
Shout out to Marie Stéphanie Delamere yesterday. Gave us a good example
right,
of that kind of
exactly,
work.
Exactly. But this is not what gets, you know, so if you, you know, you, the, Régis Debray, who is a master at sort of big meta-narratives, has just published another book, which is called, I think, Civilisation, Comment nous sommes devenus Américains. That's the subtitle of the book. And it, for me, it's very interesting because I didn't read it, I just heard about it. But it sort of seems to, it's the kind of narrative that repeats itself. It's a narrative that's been repeating itself for, you know, not just since it's Duhamel or other people in the modernist generation, but even arguably since Baudelaire and de Goncourt. I mean, you were talking about, you know, the Eiffel Tower last night. So that discourse. So there are things that just keep repeating themselves, and so it's very difficult to find the right, you know, angle for historicizing this phenomenon. You wanted to.
Well, I mean, I don't want us to end up so sad, because I'm, you know, from the happiest place on earth. And I think in particular we should beware the problems of the contemporary paradigms. So, and I think François is really putting some of those issues on the table. So let us try to sort out some of the issues. One is that because I think Catherine put these things extremely well and really laid out for us many of the issues that do characterize the digital discourse on the one hand, and that then enticed us to kind of give up the most important thing, which is history. So what I would say is, and the question for all of us, because we see it in our students, is they, in fact, do not understand context or contextualization, because they, in fact, have been only living in a circulation and in a network and in a place without diachrony, I believe, actually, without archives, where they don't understand the Enlightenment knowledge structure. And that's really the question. I think we have, you know, why you talked about Foucault earlier is for a reason, because he understood a kind of anatomy of knowledge, that we are in a kind of potential transitional moment, so that we are, I mean, I don't want to be like, you know, we're threatened, but I think that the format does generate, of course, an epistemology, right? And that is the question, which isn't just about words and images. I mean, I think we really are relate that there is a way in which this format has facilitated a word-image connection, but the format is much more about an epistemology. That epistemology challenges a certain kind of contextualization on which all of our work, whether you're a historian, an art historian, you know, a kind of anyone from the 18th century forward, in our world of lettres et art, are really struggling with. And that is why Catherine started to talk about archives. You see, I mean, it really is a much more complicated issue, which is also why things like phenomenology are kind of back. They also have trouble archivally. I mean, what is the history of phenomenology? How do you study it as a historian? You know, as a philosopher, yes. You know, this has been, and you know, Robin has worked on some of this kind of stuff, so maybe you'd have something to say too. Corporeal experience has never really been the greatest thing for historians to describe, right? Whether we've, so, you know, I was trained in some ways as a historian of the senses. And this was always the problem for Colbin, people like this. How do you really study the senses historically? Mm-hmm. So I think we're back to, and maybe people who are interested in sensory experience think history is useless. Maybe, in other words, because it is in the here and now. It's an experience. You know, this is a question in any event. So I would say, and this is why, by the way, every school, certainly in France as well, but in America, you know, art pratique. How many times have we heard the art pratique? You know, don't worry about America and, you know, the Terra's mission, forget it. It's more like, you know, the art pratique are here. Everyone, the art schools and the art history have to live together now. And, you know, we have to have artists as well as scholars, right? So this is where the practitioners are, you know, are we every semester I have a kind of battle to try to explain that I can't have doctoral students taking classes for credit from people who don't have PhDs. And now soon I'm going to have to explain actually they can take classes from people who don't have PhDs because they're really so knowledgeable anyway. That's going to be the next. So it's like Suzanne Lacy, does she have a PhD, doesn't she? This is every semester. And oh, she does have a PhD, so she can teach my graduate students. But this is the fight. So we are in a new milieu of kind of, and it is always with contemporary art, these kinds of questions of what knowledge counts. And I mean this not to be turf, you know, about turf, but it is really about this question of shift to format, which has prioritized experience. And in prioritizing experience, we have a whole new basis by which knowledge comes to be, I would say, verified. And I think that's why Francois had this kind of historical, you know, breakdown there. And I think you're absolutely right that we've had a belching forth. I mean, I worked on the 19th century, on intermediality in the 19th century, on, you know, reception culture in the 19th century. So I'm very familiar with these issues, and I don't think digital culture, you know, invented them at all. And so the last thing I just want us to think about, so I don't think we have to give up at all. So, right.
It's an opening.
Yes, okay, good. It's an opening, but we also don't want to seed certain questions about specificity, about context, because these, so the question would be, can these things about networks, are they really, you know, without time and place? That's really the question. How do we teach historicization to these spaces would be the thing I think, and that's where Jocelyt's book, I think, fails. It's a kind of a, you know, amorphous, you know, kind of trendy, you know, talk of networks without any beginning, middle, and end. And I think Francois is really, at the end of the day, saying that there's a story and a history and specificity that might help and that remains, therefore, you know, and John was saying this too, that America is a real place. It's physical, you know. So.
Oh, ça va être difficile. Non, mais j'avais une question. Ouais, enfin, c'était une remarque, en fait, sur la question des circulations et des modalités de circulation des images. Je pense qu'il y a une chose qu'il faut garder un peu à l'esprit quand on parle de circulation, c'est de réfléchir sur les différentes modalités de circulation et sur la nécessité de penser à la circulation autrement qu'en isolant la production des phénomènes de circulation et de réception. On parle beaucoup d'horizons d'attente, on parle beaucoup de diffusion, de popularisation, etc. Mais on reproduit un peu trop systématiquement un schéma diffusionniste. Or, je crois que les travaux que tu as coordonnés pour cet ouvrage et puis aussi tes travaux sur l'exposition de 67 montrent bien que la circulation a été pensée dans certains moments, y compris dans les moments politiques, selon un autre modèle qui est l'appropriation et le réinvestissement d'une forme de créativité par le public des images qui sont censées circuler. Donc c'est le cas pour l'exposition de 67 comme espèce de spectacle.
C'est pour Eiffel et pour Disneyland. Enfin, je veux dire, c'est clair que c'est... Oui. Oui.
Et puis c'est le cas aussi dans certains types de propagande politique où la dissémination des images est pensée comme une sorte de retour d'aller-retour du visuel et de remonter en fait aussi de l'information visuelle vers des organes de diffusion, une sorte d'accélérateur permanent d'une circulation, appropriation et remise en circulation de motifs visuels. Et voilà, donc c'était juste une remarque générale méthodologique sur la notion de circulation.
Merci. Yeah, oui, au fond, Constance.
Juste une courte remarque ou commentaire. Sur cette question de la circulation par rapport aux expériences contemporaines, enfin dans l'art contemporain, je dis circulation d'expérience justement parce qu'on a évoqué cette idée d'expérience et non d'image. Pensez aussi à des pratiques où les artistes vont aujourd'hui contre la circulation des images et pour une circulation de l'expérience uniquement. Et où on a justement les artistes qui vont essayer de penser la mutation actuelle dans la société. Certes, on parle de circulation libre des images, de circulation libre, mais on a aussi le développement d'une économie de l'expérience et qui va être justement réinterprétée par les artistes en disant on interdit la circulation des images, les œuvres circulent. Alors je pense par exemple au plus connu et dont on parle beaucoup comme Tino Segal, hein, qui est cet artiste qui va justement... La performance circule et recréée localement. Beaucoup de gens peuvent avoir vu ces performances reprises par d'autres personnes. Les images circulent, mais de manière illégale, c'est-à-dire que la circulation des images a été rendue interdite par l'artiste. Donc, qu'est-ce que la circulation d'une œuvre quand la circulation des images est interdite et que les artistes travaillent sur la circulation de l'expérience ?
Oui, tout à fait, c'est très important. Et c'est la question tout à l'heure, Hélène avait fait allusion à ce phénomène déjà en parlant du fait que qu'il y a beaucoup de, non seulement que les circulations, enfin que les choses disparaissent, mais que il y a beaucoup, enfin l'espace dont on parle quand on parle de circulation, immédiate et infinie, c'est Internet. Et que cet espace-là ne reste que l'un des espaces et pas forcément celui qui est le plus représentatif des modes de propriété, de valorisation des choses aujourd'hui. C'est-à-dire qu'il y a énormément de choses qui circulent sur Internet comme des images pauvres, comme a dit Catherine, ne circulent pas, ne peuvent pas circuler par ailleurs pour différentes raisons, qui ont notamment à voir avec les questions de contrôle ou de censure, et il y avait des questions, je dirais aussi strictement, basiquement économiques, et que donc on est aussi dans un univers assez paradoxal et assez complexe où on va admettre ou se contenter ou laisser exister une circulation un peu grise de choses plus ou moins contrôlables sur Internet tout en recréant bon gré mal gré une économie de l'expérience raréfiée comme celle dont on parlait. Vas-y.
Je peux peut-être rajouter quelque chose. Le cas de Tino Segal est un cas absolument exemplaire, puisque donc effectivement il interdit la captation de ses performances, y compris dans un contexte de globalisation, puisqu'il a en particulier été très très strict sur la captation de These Associations, qui était une commission dans le cadre des Unilever Series de la Turbine Hall de Tate Modern. On ne peut pas faire plus global et plus capitalistique. Et il a interdit donc la captation. Il traque toutes les images de cette performance sur Internet. Il est très très rigoureux. I can tell you he's very rigorous. Donc vraiment, et à côté, ça me permet de faire le lien avec ce que disait Vanessa. Je pense que effectivement, par exemple, le cas de Tino Segal ne peut se comprendre que si on historicise en fait la pensée, l'esthétique de la figure de l'artiste au XXe siècle depuis le modernisme. C'est-à-dire la posture de Tino Segal n'a de sens que si on l'inscrit dans un récit historique, effectivement, et en particulier le récit historique de la construction conceptuelle de l'artiste telle que cette conception a été définie, mise en place par le modernisme, hein, tel qu'il s'entend depuis Duchamp. Donc, c'est-à-dire que ça n'a de sens qu'à l'intérieur d'une histoire, et à l'intérieur d'une histoire des pratiques, et à l'intérieur d'une histoire des concepts qu'on utilise pour comprendre ces pratiques. Donc, c'est juste pour faire le lien avec ce que disait Vanessa. Évidemment, mon propos n'était pas du tout de déshistoriciser, mais au contraire, de plaider pour une double historicisation à la fois des pratiques et des concepts qu'on utilise pour comprendre ces pratiques. Donc une historicisation aussi des cadres méthodologiques, des métaphores, etc., que peut-être parfois certains n'historicisent pas suffisamment. Et je pense que c'est cette double historicisation qui est essentielle pour comprendre, je reviens à ce que disaient François et Hélène précédemment, la spécificité, et c'est tout le travail d'Hélène en particulier, la spécificité d'une certaine image, de son avatar dans un contexte spécifique, etc., et du cadre épistémologique utilisé pour comprendre cette image à un moment donné. Mais à mes yeux, si on ne travaille pas sur cette double historicisation, on a beaucoup de mal, effectivement, à faire le travail pour lequel plaide François, c'est-à-dire de réancrage, de recontextualisation, qui reste toujours... Enfin, c'est une tangente, on n'y arrivera jamais, mais c'est ce travail tangentiel sur cette double historicisation, je crois qu'il faut continuer à faire, même quand on travaille sur l'ultra-contemporain.
Bon, une dernière question, peut-être.
Oui. Pardon, parce que c'est moins une question qu'un commentaire. Mais d'autant plus que les dernières remarques qui ont été faites vont tout à fait dans le sens de ce que j'avais envie de dire, c'est-à-dire cette question de l'appropriation des usages, de la remise en diachronie et d'une appréhension, quand tu as cité Debray, de la médiologie, d'une histoire dans la longue durée, qui inclut d'ailleurs une réflexion sur l'histoire des éphémères dans la longue durée. Donc ça, je pense que c'est une donnée importante. En fait, la question que je voulais introduire dans le débat, c'est la question de la géographie artistique et d'une modalité de communication actuelle qui, en fait, au lieu de dissocier, comme on l'a fait depuis Lessing, l'espace et le temps, conduit à synthétiser l'espace et le temps et à penser vraiment une forme d'espace-temps et une sorte de multidimensionnalité de nos expériences. Et je voulais introduire un peu cette question-là tout ce qu'a dit Vanessa Schwartz sur le mouvement, etc. Ça ne peut se comprendre qu'en réfléchissant à la question de l'espace et du temps combiné. Et donc il me semble que dans cette conception, cette espèce de révolution médiologique qu'on est en train de vivre, il y a cette dimension-là qui est forte et qui mérite d'être soulignée. Et je voulais aussi mettre en évidence le travail, alors plus sur la géographie artistique, mené par Béatrice Joyeux-Prunel et Catherine Dossin sur les circulations. Et il me semble que l'approche géographique, puisque la géographie, c'est une discipline qui aborde la question des espaces multiples et entrelacer les espaces sociaux, les espaces nationaux, les espaces politiques, les espaces médiatiques, etc., et les espaces même physiques, c'est une chose qui me semble très importante à rappeler.
Je crois qu'on est absolument d'accord et on est vraiment alors là dans le paradigme de la circulation, c'est-à-dire que les relevés de d'images de Google par toute géolocalisation est aussi une localisation dans le temps. Les deux choses sont inséparables et toutes les cartographies, celles auxquelles tu fais allusion, de l'équipe de l'ENS et d'autres sont complètement dans ce type d'atlas. Qui est toujours des atlas absolument spatio-temporels. Je pense que c'est très important effectivement de le rappeler. Ça, je pense qu'on a aussi... on voit aussi les effets de ce type d'approche sur toute une série d'objets de plus en plus divers et variés. On en est tous plus ou moins à faire des atlas. de même qu'on est tous dans les dans des archives ou des rêves d'archives, on est aussi tous dans les atlas. C'est ça fait aussi partie de la progression de cette logique de la circulation. Je crois qu'on peut être s'arrêter là. Oui. Ok. Donc il nous reste à vous remercier, à remercier tout le monde d'avoir et participé à ces journées et au prochain numéro pour le prochain volume de la collection Terra.
Et merci à François et aux amis de la Terra. Merci beaucoup. Hein.
Merci à Constance.